Senate will come to order. Chief Clerk, call the roll.
Roll call for Tuesday, February 22nd. Barnard?
Here.
Bebout? Burns?
Here.
Case?
Here.
Christensen?
Coe? Here.
Cooper?
Here.
Dockstader?
Here.
Driscoll?
Here.
Emmerich?
Excuse.
Esquibel?
Here.
Geis?
Here.
Hastert? Hicks,
here.
Hines,
here.
Jennings,
here.
Johnson,
here.
Landon,
here.
Martin,
here.
Meyer,
here.
Nicholas,
here.
Nutting,
here.
Perkins,
here.
Peterson,
here.
Ross,
here.
Rothfuss,
here.
Schiffer,
here.
Scott,
here.
Von Flateren,
here.
President Anderson,
here.
Bebout,
excused.
Christensen,
excused.
27 present, 3 excused.
Prayer by Reverend Robinson.
Good morning. Is this on? Okay, very good. It's good to be with you again. Will you pray with me? Good and holy God, creator of beautiful places and beautiful people, may your wisdom guide these people in their work of caring for your creation so that they may hear you say, it is good. Gracious and mighty God, healer of brokenness and despair, may your compassion guide these people in the use of their power so that they may hear you say, good and faithful servant. Forgiving and merciful God, finder of the lost and mistaken souls, may your love flow over these people and their failings, so that they may hear you say, you are forgiven. Gathering an inclusive God, builder of community and unifier of diversity, may your fellowship envelop these people in their thoughts and work, so that they may hear you say, we are one. Refining and completing God, finisher of all that is to be, may your creation be aided by the efforts of these people, so that all who see the fruits of their labor might know that you have been with them every step of the way. May it be so. Amen.
Please join me in the pledge. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Will the reading clerk please read the journal committee report?
Mr. President, your journal committee reports of the Journal of February the 18th, 2011, has been read and recommends that it be approved. Senator Nutting, Chairman.
Are there any objections? There being none, the report is adopted. Doctor for the day is Kim Broomfield. Kim is from Cheyenne. Nurses for the day are Peggy Bezinson and Bev Jensen, and those folks are from the Wyoming State Hospital in Evanston, and we'd thank them as well. On this day in Wyoming history in 1944, a Casper pair denied gas rationings after alleged violations. On this day in U.S. history, today George Washington would have been 279 years old. And in 1630, popcorn was introduced to English colonists by the Indians. Wow, what a name. When Quadquinine, brother of Massasoit, brought a bag for the colonists. Concurrences. Senator, Mr. Majority Floor Leader, go ahead.
President, just if I may, a privilege of the floor.
You may.
Members of the Senate, you will see in your red files a draft of, and I want to emphasize, a draft only of potential appointments by the governor. Those are four-year review and four-year review only. Should you have any qualms about any potential appointment, you can then highlight that, and we'll give you an opportunity to express that downstairs if you so desire. But these will then be collected, and you'll see they're numbered at the top right-hand corner. These will be collected later on this afternoon, and then you'll receive a final draft or a final report from the governor's office with regards to proposed appointments. And then tomorrow we will take up, by way of caucus consideration of those appointments. We have 5 days to deal with the governor's appointments. The first day is actually starts tomorrow. And so Monday would be our day where we have to actually vote on confirmation of these appointments. So this is in your files for your review, and then, like I said, keep them in your red file, and they'll be picked up later on this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Majority Floor Leader. Concurrence. Senator Burns, are you ready on message number 353? Okay, go ahead, Senator Burns. I say go ahead. You fine? Okay, go ahead and read that in. Would you, with the reading clerk, please read that message in.
February the 18th, 2011, from the House of Representatives, message number 353. Concurrence requested, Mr. President. Senate file 88, expungement of nonviolent felonies. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 43, noes 15, excused 2. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendment. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Go ahead, Senator Burns.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move message 353 for Senate file 88, expungement of nonviolent felonies, and ask the body to vote aye. Mr. President, if you look at the engrossed bill and then look at the amendments, the two major changes that you see, actually is three major changes, is on line two, they get rid of the word nonviolent and put in the word certain. That was at the request of LSO because nonviolent is actually would have been a category in its own right. This way, it's more encompassing. And so the main, after that, the main amendments that the House put in was for the waiting time or the time in which to react to the petition was moved from 30 days up to first 60, then to 90 days. Mr. President, I don't consider that a big deal. It makes it easier on the agencies involved, and this person has waited 10 years, and quite often these crimes that for which they're seeking expungement are years in the past, so they have to go to archives and so forth. So I don't consider that to be an undue burden on the petitioner. And then the other big amendment is on page 2 of the amendments, and you'll see a big list of offenses. These offenses were at the request of the county prosecutors and the district attorneys in the state. And I would like to go over those so people know what we're talking about, rather than just say violent felonies as defined by WS 61104A Romanet 7. I'll just go through the list of what they actually are. That first one is any violent felony, murder, manslaughter, kidnapping, any of those. That covers the violent felonies. The next one, B, is homicide by vehicle. C is drug-induced homicide. D is all felony sex offenses. E is battery against a household member, which is a topic and issue that we've discussed on the floor here of the Senate. F is child abuse. G is aggravated assault and battery on a corrections or detention officer. H is possession, manufacture, transportation, or sale of explosives. J is promoting prostitution. K is sexual exploitation of a minor. M is bribery. N is interference with a peace officer or disarming a peace officer. O is escape or escape by violence. P is perjury. Q is use of a firearm while committing a felony or possession of a firearm by a felon. R is any sex registration offenses. We had discussed that. And S is felony DUI. T is drug possession, felony drug possession. And, Mr. Chairman, there are two more offenses that were added on the floor of the Senate. I'm sorry, on the floor of the House. One is incest, and the other is endangering children by giving them drugs. And, Mr. President, frankly, I don't know that any of those amendments, or any of those offenses should be subject to expungement, so I would agree to go with the House on these particular amendments. And I believe that takes care of all the amendments that the House had, and I would ask the body to vote aye or take any questions somebody might have, like a tall, silver-haired senator from Fremont County.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. President. Just a question on T, and I didn't get a chance to look it up in the statutes, but under possession of marijuana, they have a misdemeanor, and then there's several offenses before they actually get to a felony. So for that, those young people that may have, in fact, had a possession of that or a controlled substance, are we eliminating them the possibilities of being included in this, or is this a higher level of a felony, and it's something that we for sure are not allow them to do?
Other questions or discussion before Senator? Senator Scott, go ahead.
Mr. President, I tell you, my instinct is to vote no on this. I'm beginning to wonder if the House left anything that was included. They've excluded a number of things here. The homicide by vehicle. Some of those things, I really wonder, passage of time, if some of the expungement isn't appropriate. We can always be more punitive, and I think that's how we've gotten ourselves in trouble, is by being excessively punitive in some of these things. Once somebody's served their time and stayed clean for a period of time, it makes sense to me that we ought to expunge some of these. Mr. President, I think it's worth going back and talking to the House. I think maybe the list is a little too long.
Others? Seeing none, Senator Burns, you'd like to speak to those?
Yes, Mr. President. In response to the first good senator who stood up and spoke, both of whom are taller than me, as a matter of fact, for felony drug possession, that is for large quantities, basically the idea of saleable quantities of drugs. In response to the second senator, from the tall one from Natrona County, I thank you for your input. If I had my druthers or my dithers, I might have wanted to pare down some of these offenses that they have listed here. But the fact is, this is a new concept to the law in the state of Wyoming. And I would rather, frankly, get it on the books, and then we can tweak various crimes as time goes on over the next years or so in deciding what we think should be expungible and what we should not. I gave a lot of deference to the county attorneys and the district attorneys in this because, frankly, they're on the front lines. They're the ones who are dealing with criminals in the first place. And from their perspective, they're the ones who are actually arresting and convicting him, and now we're coming along saying, now you can just forget about it. So I wanted everybody who had some skin in the game to have a level of comfort with the idea of this new concept going on the books, and I think it's something that can and hopefully be further refined as the years go on.
Thank you, Senator Burns. The motion is that the Senate do concur on Senate File 88. You've been asked to vote aye. Chief Clerk, please call the roll.
Barnard?
Aye.
Bebout?
No.
Burns?
Aye.
Case?
No.
Christensen?
Aye.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
Dockstader?
Aye.
Driscoll?
No.
Amrick? Excused. Esquibel?
No.
Geis?
No.
Hastert?
Aye.
Hicks?
No.
Hines?
Aye.
Jennings?
No.
Johnson?
Aye.
Landon?
No.
Martin?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
Nicholas?
No.
Nutting?
Aye.
Perkins?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Ross?
No.
Rothfuss?
No.
Schiffer?
Aye.
Scott?
No.
Von Flatern?
Aye.
President Anderson?
Aye.
Closing vote? Closing. Vote closed. 17 ayes, 12 noes, 1 excused.
By your vote, you have concurred on Senate File 88. Senator Ross, are you ready in regard to message number 354? Go ahead, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. I am ready, and I move message number 354.
Okay, let's have the clerk read that in at this time.
February the 18th, 2011, from the House of Representatives. Message number 354, concurrence requested, Mr. President. Senate File 89, Adult Protective Services. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 57, noes 1, excused 2. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Go ahead, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. I do move message 354, concurrence request with regard to reference Senate File 89, Adult Protective Services. Members of the Senate, this is a simple amendment that was added by the House as they tend to piddle. And this little piddle doesn't mean much. They took out the word non-consensual on page 5, which is in the definition of sexual abuse. And it's inconsequential because sexual abuse, we define in that statute the various types of sexual assault or battery, sexual exploitation, and so forth. And certainly none of those are consensual, so it really doesn't mean a whole heck of a lot, so I ask you to vote aye.
Discussion? Seeing none, the motion is that the Senate do concur on Senate File 89. You've been asked to vote aye. Would the Chief Clerk please call the roll?
Barnard?
Aye.
Bebout?
Aye.
Burns?
Aye.
Case?
Aye.
Christensen?
Aye.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
Dockstader?
Aye.
Driscoll?
Aye.
Amrick excused. Esquibel?
Aye.
Geis?
Aye.
Hastert?
Aye.
Hicks? Hines,
aye.
Jennings,
aye.
Johnson,
aye.
Landon,
aye.
Martin,
aye.
Meyer,
no.
Nicholas,
aye.
Nutting,
aye.
Perkins,
aye.
Peterson,
aye.
Ross,
aye.
Rothfuss,
aye.
Schiffer,
aye.
Scott,
aye.
Von Flatern,
aye.
President Anderson.
Aye.
Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. 28 ayes, 1 no, and 1 excuse.
By your vote, you have concurred on Senate File 89. Joint Conference Committee report on Senate File 128. Senator Hines, are you ready on message number House message 323 in reference to Senate File 128.
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, Senator Hines.
I have to read it in.
We'll read that in at this time.
Joint Conference Committee report, Senate File 128, abandoned vehicle storage expenses. Reference House message number 323 to engross copy. Signing for the House. Representative Peasley, Green, and Branish, signing for the Senate, Hines and Christensen.
Now go ahead, Senator.
Mr. President, I move that we do adopt Joint Conference Committee report to Senate File 128, referenced message number 323. This was the abandoned vehicle storage fee bill that I had put in, and we had raised it from $5 to $20 that allow the independent businessmen to charge. When it went to the House side, well, they amended it. They first didn't allow any increase from the $5 till after 30 days, and then they changed it to $10 a day. Our agreement was that we would just delete their amendment and further amend it where it was $10 a day from day one continuously. So I asked you to adopt this report.
Okay. The motion is that the Senate do adopt Joint Conference Committee 1 report in regard to message 323, which references Senate File 128. And you've been asked to vote aye. Would the Chief Clerk please call the roll?
Barnard? Aye. Bebout?
Aye.
Burns?
Aye.
Case?
Aye.
Christensen?
Aye.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
Dockstader?
Aye.
Driscoll?
Aye.
Emmerich excused. Esquivel?
Aye.
Geis?
Aye.
Hastert?
Aye.
Hicks?
Aye.
Hines?
Aye.
Jennings?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Landon?
Aye.
Martin?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
Nicholas?
Aye.
Nutting?
Aye.
Perkins?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
Rothfuss?
Aye.
Schiffer?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Von Fleitern?
Aye.
President Anderson?
Aye.
Closing vote? Closing. Vote closed. 28 ayes, 1 no, 1 excused.
By your vote, you have adopted Joint Conference Committee number 1, report on message 323, reference to Senate File 128. Senator Case, I've just been handed a concurrence in regard to message number 299. Are you ready? Okay, that would be no problem. We'll set that back for a little while later, perhaps this afternoon. I think we have some enrolled acts. Senate Enrolled Act 40.
Senate Enrolled Act 40 being original Senate File 14.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act in reference to the original Senate File 14. As so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 41.
Senate Enrolled Act number 41 being original Senate File 36.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 41 in reference to the original Senate File 36. If so, sign. Senate Enrolled Act number 42.
Senate Enrolled Act number 42 being original Senate File 39.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 42. Same Senate File 39. Have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 43.
Senate Enrolled Act number 43 being original Senate File 7.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 43 being original Senate File 7. So signed. Senate Enrolled Act 44.
Senate Enrolled Act number 44 being original Senate File 16.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 44, original Senate File 16. And so signed. I'm about to Senate Enrolled Act 45.
Senate Enrolled Act number 45, being original Senate file 57.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 45, original Senate file 57. I have so signed. I'm about to see. This is in regard to House Enrolled Act 27.
House Enrolled Act number 27, being original House Bill 28.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 27, original House Bill 28. Have so signed. House Enrolled Act number 28.
House Enrolled Act number 28, being original House Bill 69.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 28, original House Bill 69. Have so signed. House Enrolled Act number 29.
House Enrolled Act number 29, being original House Bill 157.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 29, original House Bill 157. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act number 30.
House Enrolled Act number 30, being original House Bill 160.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 30, original House Bill 160. Have so signed. We have a joint conference committee appointment. This is in regard to message number 307, joint conference committee, in regard to Senate file 71. Those people appointed to that are Christensen, Bebout, and Hastert. That is in regard to Senate File 71. Reports from standing committees.
February the 18th, 2011, Mr. President. Your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom was referred House Bill 256, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins, Senator Perkins, Chairman.
Bill's on second reading. House Bill 127, second reading of the House Bill.
House Bill 127, School Finance Recalibration, sponsored by the School Finance Committee.
There is an amendment, and I would ask the reading clerk, there are several amendments, I'd ask the reading clerk to read in the First Amendment at this time.
House Bill 127, second reading amendment number 1 to engross copy, page 12, line 17.
Senator Von Platerd, would you like to move and speak to the amendment, please?
Thank you, Mr. President. I move second reading amendment number 1 to House Bill 127 and ask that we dispense with further reading. Where this amendment goes in, as you know, there's a requirement within the bill that within K-3 that you have a 16-to-1 ratio at the various school districts. But there was no instructions as to when you would apply for it, how you would be qualified or not, when the answer would come back, whether you had to comply or your request for waiver was good enough to that the school board or Board of Education agreed with your request. And so there was no timing. And that's all this amendment does, is that it goes in there to say about halfway down the amendment, it says, obtain a waiver under this paragraph. A school district shall apply to the state board not later than March 15th of each year, and that the application shall be based on the student-teacher ratio reported by the Department of Ed, together with any other information required by the state board, And the State Board shall approve or deny an application for a waiver under this paragraph not later than April 10th of that year. So, in October, they report their actual enrollment. Through January, February, the Department of Ed cleans it up, makes sure it's not a child they're counting that transferred from another school. So by about April 1st, or March 1st, Department of Ed has actual numbers and verified, and they have the true numbers of students, total students in the state, plus in every district and school. So what we're saying is by March 1st, you can apply, and they'll have actual numbers. By March 15th, the Department of Ed will tell you whether they verify it. And then by April 1st, the Board of Ed will meet and come back to the districts and tell them that whether or not their waiver is good. Yes, we understand why you can't have 16-1 in that particular school. Or that their waiver is not good, and they're saying hire another teacher, or your transportation costs aren't whatever, so you can move a couple kids. You know, I'm not getting into that. All I'm doing is saying these are the dates in which to apply. They have verified numbers, and the Department of or Board of Education, per this bill, will make that decision. All the amendment does is put dates in as to when you do it, and then that'll be for the next August, the next school year, when you need to enact it. So I ask for your favorable vote on Amendment Number 1.
Discussion or questions? Go ahead, Senator Coe.
Mr. President, I rise in support of the amendment, and I'll tell you why. We had an incredible discussion in the interim on class size. I mean, it was big. We had expert after expert, consultant after consultant tell us how important a 16 class size is, particularly in K-3. Now, we have little cases that exist out there. Is 16 going to be the drop-dead number? Is 18? What is that? It's going to be, as we try to implement this class size into our system, and it's very, very important, as we try to implement this in, we've got to have some flexibility. What it relates specifically to square footage available, teachers available, whatever that might be. I'd ask that you support this amendment because it does provide for a waiver. Are we ultimately trying to get to 16? No question about it. That's what this amendment does, and I urge that you support the amendment.
Other discussion, Senator Schiffer? Go ahead.
Mr. President, a question for the sponsor. When they go in for this waiver, in those you know, sometimes you get a large class roll through a district, you know, bad TV the winter before or whatever it is. Does this allow, if the school district says, okay, we're going to go over, as part of their waiver, we're going to put a teacher aide, we're going to put a paralegal, para, whatever it is. Is that grounds, what is it? Oh, I thought somebody had the right word. Whatever they call the people they put in. Is that grounds for the waiver then to accommodate one of those big classes coming through?
Other discussion or question to the sponsor before he responds? Seeing none, Senator Von Flederden, would you like to respond to this?
Thank you, Mr. President. And an answer to the good senator from KC is that they're called like instructional aides. So you could have tutors, instructional aides, and classroom aides, they call them in some districts. What we've always said is tutors qualify as teachers because they are a certified teacher. Instructional aides, when you get into instructional aides, which they do not have a certification or a definition, and that's one of the great arguments, is that districts will want to put instructional aides in and say, oh, we've got a better staff-to-student ratio is what they're speaking of. They're not speaking teacher-to-student ratio. They're just talking staff. Well, in our model, we don't count for staff. Some districts go as far, not in our state, but in other states, go as far as to count everybody in the building and all the students in the building and divide it by all the administration and all the staff and say, I see, we've got a 4-to-1 or a 3-to-1 ratio. But that's including secretaries and everybody else. So, no, you're talking about instructional aides, and that wouldn't count towards this, even though their ratio is better. But, once again, we're leaving up to the Department of our Board of Education to make that final decision. All this is really doing is putting in dates as to when you apply and when you find out, giving you enough time to get ready for the next school year.
Next question. Question in regard to second reading amendment number 1 to House Bill 127. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That amendment has passed. We are now on to the second amendment. I'd ask the reading clerk read in the second amendment at this time.
House Bill 127, second reading amendment number 2 to engross copy, page 9, line 9.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, I move adoption of this amendment. Mr. President, this amendment goes to one of the areas that is a cause of the inadequate performance in our schools. One of the ways that a student can get in the most trouble, Mr. President, is when they don't learn how to read in the first few grades. A student that doesn't learn how to read in the early grades is going to be just an impossible position the older they get. And a number of years ago, we enacted a program based on a successful program in the state of Arkansas, where we required an assessment at the end of the first few grades, and this bill stretched it to 3 grades, which makes sense, which kids are not learning how to read, and say, let's have an investigation and an individualized plan for that child so that they will learn how to read. We're going in with some specific remediation, and it's important that you take a look at each child as an individual, because children are very different. Reading is not something that really comes naturally, and there'll be various different reasons. And the remedy for the problem needs to relate, Mr. President, to the reason that the child is not learning how to read. And the bill, as it comes to us, says that students not showing appropriate competence on this section shall be placed on an individualized or group reading plan. No. They want to be on an individualized plan, which may include a group reading plan, or it may not. Depends what the problem is, and will the group reading plan solve the problem? So what this amendment is doing is going back to the original language. It's got to be placed on an individualized reading plan, but that individualized reading plan may include a group reading program, Mr. President, because that makes sense when that's what cures the particular problem of this particular child. But you've got to individualize the plan, because you've got to understand why it is that this particular child is not reading. The way it's written in the bill, I'm sure a number of districts would like to do it that way. It's a good deal less work, Mr. President, but it doesn't produce the results. And the failure of some of the districts to follow this and to just put everybody into a group plan because that's easiest is one of the reasons so many of our third and fourth graders don't know how to read well. Mr. President, I urge adoption of the amendment.
Comment? Question, Senator Coe? Go ahead.
Well, Mr. President, this is going to require more resources probably at the school and the district level, but to be candid and honest with you, you know, teachers realize when they have kids that aren't reading like they should. And I think, and it's not a lot of kids, maybe, but I think an individualized reading program, when you can pick a kid out that is really in trouble, and that's what I think this amendment does. You pick out a kid that's really in trouble with reading, this says we're going to do some one-on-one. And I think it's an appropriate amendment. They still have the flexibility to have a group reading program. And I commend the senator from Natrona County for bringing the amendment. It puts some teeth into it. And we're serious about kids being able to read by third grade. So I think this is a good amendment.
Other discussion? Seeing none, are we ready for the question? Question being called. Regard to second reading amendment number 2, House Bill 127. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That second amendment has passed. We are now on the third amendment, and I'd ask the reading clerk to read that amendment in at this time.
House Bill 127, second reading amendment 3 to engross copy, page 1, line 6.
Senator Nicholas, would you like to speak to that, please?
I would, Mr. President. I move second reading amendment number 3 to House Bill 127. Folks, this returns to the issue of how do we deal with minimum class sizes throughout the district. And this proposes that we eliminate the language that was put in by the House that was not part of the interim work, and then put into a Section 5, a non-statutory provision, trying to develop and see where we're going to get at the end with respect to class sizes. I urge your support of the amendment for a couple reasons. One is I think that the existing language remains to be flawed, and two, that we simply don't have all the information that we need to make this determination. It may be a very expensive process. By way of history, when the recalibration, or not recalibration, but when the school finance first legislation came about, the House had a provision that would require minimum class sizes of 16. That was rejected by the Senate, and we've been struggling with this ever since Campbell won. The issue is difficult because we've talked about these bubble areas. In the existing language, all you're required to have is an average class size. So you could have one class in a demographic area that has a lot of students that has 23, and on the other side of town you could have a class with 5 students, and the average is where you want to be. That doesn't take care of the problem, so that when the House sent the bill over, they said we want every class to be 16 or more or less. We've already put an amendment that says an average of 16 so that we're not going to be busing children. I've always been a proponent that we ought to have 16 or smaller class sizes, and if that requires busing, so be it, because the quality of education is more important than the convenience of walking across the school to the neighborhood school if you're the 17th student. However, historically, we've not gone that route. We said, you know, if you're the 17th kid, maybe you ought to go to that classroom, go with your friends, and it's more important to have you with your colleagues and neighborhood kids than it is to have to be bused across town to a school that demographically only has 14 or 13 kids in order to have a strict number. Well, if you're going to say that districts only need to have an average, then what about charter schools? What about all of the other exceptions? We don't know now what it would cost us to require to provide facilities for all these classes if we insisted on 16 per class. We also don't have the data out that tells us whether it's better to have a class of 17 kids or 18 kids versus shipping 2 of the children across town to another district. So I think we need to take a look at this. I think we need more information yet. So what I propose is we delete the new language that was put in by the House, and then put in the language that says, look, let's have all the districts report to us by October 1st, and we'd like a plan. They need to submit to us a plan to get everybody at 16 to or less, and then also provide us a basis for any exceptions to that and why they need those exceptions, and is showing that they believe that student performance would not be affected or impaired if we provided these exceptions. So let's get more information. Let's say we're serious about this. We do want to work towards this, but we simply need more information. We don't have we have the generic research that says 16 or smaller should provide better performance. We don't have any Wyoming experience on this issue because we're still getting into the accountability issue. And if we're going to make exceptions and say, look, you can do it average across the county, then we're not serious about it anyway. So let's say, give us a plan to get to 16 per class. Tell us why you can't do it, why you don't want to do it, and why you think it would impair student learning to force you into that configuration. At the same time, we need to figure out whether we can do it with existing resources, which is included in the amendment. I'd urge your support.
Questions? Senator Cole, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. President. Well, you have a decision in front of you here. And with the amendment we just passed, I happen to like quite a bit. You know, what we have, though, is we have a situation clearly that exists with charter schools out there. Charter schools are going to have trouble complying to 16. They have limitations as to what they can and can't do. clearly there's no question about that. I think if you want to bring an amendment that talks about the charter school situation, bring a separate amendment that talks about performance or some other way to tie how they're doing with their class size to that. As I said before, we had, now we're going to put this off, basically all the stuff we did in the interim, all the discussions we had in the interim, not totally, but some of it, till October 1st. And we were serious about class size when we talked about it. Very, very serious about it. We really believe in it. I guess I ask that you defeat this amendment, bring back another amendment on third reading, maybe, if you can, and let's specifically address some of those concerns that we have with charter schools out there, because they're genuine concerns. We've all heard about it. I guess at this point in time, I'd ask that you defeat the amendment.
Senator Roth, let's go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and for the amendment, but when I say that, I don't say it because I am opposed to the objective of what we've got in the House amendment that they have here, trying to get to 16 to 1, Mr. President. I think that this is a goal that we realize is a noble goal, and it's best for the education of the kids in K through 3. The reason I support this amendment is we're just at a position where I don't think we do have enough data and enough detail in this amendment to get us where we want to go. From testimony and from email and from a lot of other sources, we are hearing so many problems with achieving the 16 to 1 ratio, and it's not just charter schools. Small schools are going to have similar problems. Mr. President, if you've only got 20 third graders in your school district, it's very difficult to deal with that from a financial standpoint when the model produces a certain number of teachers for you, and there's no way you can achieve that 16 to 1 without breaking them into two classes. Now all of a sudden, 1 year, you need an extra third grade teacher, but next year, you might only have 16 kids. There's not enough flexibility, and I realize, Mr. President, that we have the ability to waive in this, but I'm not entirely sure how that waiver works. What if the school board just says no? There's not enough detail in this amendment to provide a reasonable process. If the school board comes back and says, no, I'm not even sure, Mr. President, what that means. Does that mean they don't get money? Does that mean that we don't have enough resources to get to a 16 to 1 student ratio, so the school board is going to say, well, you can't make it, you haven't justified it, we're going to withhold some of the money that you don't have enough of already? There's just so many problems that I do feel that while there was this interim concern, it wasn't sufficiently addressed with the amendment from the House side, and I haven't seen any language yet that really gives me a lot of confidence that we're going to be okay moving forward. You know, this issue that we heard from the senator from KC discussing the instructional aides, what do we do with those individuals? That's another key point. And from a financial standpoint, you can hire about 3 instructional facilitators per teacher. And a lot of times that might be the best course of action. My son is actually in a school, I think his class size is about 19, but they've just got instructional facilitators or aides. No, not facilitators, excuse me. Instructional facilitators are a professional position. Instructional aides are the ones that are non-professional. I misspoke there. But they've got instructional aides swarming that classroom. I have nothing but confidence in the fact that they're properly teaching those children to read in the classroom and that they're sufficiently resourced. So, Mr. President, I urge support for this particular amendment and a lot of additional consideration over the interim, perhaps through the vehicle that we have in SF-70, to try and figure out how to address this with a solid piece of legislation that takes all of these concerns into account rather than rushing through with the House amendment that we have that I don't think really gets to the heart of the problem in an effective manner, Mr. President. So, again, on and for the amendment.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, a question for the proponents of the amendment. When it gets to busing, it's one thing to bus the 17th and the 18th child in a classroom across town. What happens in our small schools when we have young children in the early grades and they're the 17th and 18th, and we now have to bus them from Medicine Bowl all the way to Saratoga, or do we have to hire another teacher? I guess I'd like to understand more of the implications in the context of a strict 16 on our small schools and what that means as far as busing.
Senator Hines, go ahead.
Mr. President, speaking in support of the amendment, what I'm looking at and thinking about, that we've had this 16 to number in our model for 10 years, and we've known for 10 years that many school districts wasn't following it. So all of a sudden we have a bill that goes into effect. I'm not sure now whether it's the 1st of July or immediately. Anyway, it just gives a few months before it goes into effect. And I think we need to give them a little time to correct this. And this would at least, we could see their plan on what they would want to do. When we haven't paid any attention to that model number ourselves, I find it difficult that all of a sudden we have to force every district in the state to follow it in less than a year. So I would speak in favor of the amendment.
Is there any other discussion before the... We'll go to Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. President. I, too, rise on in support of the amendment. You know, the information that I've been receiving from our district and districts from around the state, it's kind of all over the map as far as the issues that each of the districts are facing. They try to do good counts for the kindergartens each year, and then they get all of a sudden inundated with kids. We've talked about facility issues and aid issues and being able to have the resources there. And I think this is the exact kind of information that we have in a component that's been missing from our education committees and from our appropriations committees on how that we can best serve the kids, you know, in getting these reports from the district, because I do believe it's all over the map and the issues that the districts are facing. And I, for one, I think it would be a great opportunity to have them, you know, put it down in writing to us and show the committees why they're having these kind of problems. Totally support the idea and the concept of getting to 16, and I think that this will give the districts the opportunity to demonstrate to the several, you know, committees why they're unable to do that. And maybe that would help us better understand, you know, block grant problems and things like that. So on in it for the amendment.
Other discussion before the sponsor rises for a second time. Senator Cole, second.
Well, Mr. President, you know, what you have in front of you here is a decision, clearly a decision. The amendment we just passed is a good amendment. This amendment, probably a pretty good amendment as well. But the question in front of the group right now is, do we really, really want to be serious about class size, about that discussion? Do we want to go ahead and proceed with class size discussion? With the waiver in the previous amendment, I think it does that. We took a lot of testimony in the interim, a lot of testimony about class size, more than we probably wanted. So you have a decision right now if you really want to jump into class size and say, we are serious about talking about class size. You would defeat the amendment. If you want to put it off till October 1st and allow more data to come in and have every district that has every little intricacy that makes it unique, I guess we could do that. Vote the amendment up or vote it down. It's more of a policy decision, but I can tell you I think we need to be serious about class size.
Any other discussion before second time, Senator Rothfuss?
Thank you, Mr. President. There was one more point that I didn't mention last time that I had heard in some testimony, which was concern that if we constrain only the K-3 class sizes, that what will end up happening won't be a hiring of new teachers. It'll simply be a shift from the 4-6 level or whatever else is at the elementary school to the K-3. So while we have seen studies, Mr. President, that indicates that the K-3 is certainly the important time, it won't necessarily have that benefit that we're looking for, which again points to me to the fact that we need to work this a little bit better and a little bit harder before we dive into constraining the class sizes.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. President. One thing that we should remember is not the last recalibration committee, but the one before. Class size was one of the biggest things that we talked about. That was 5 years ago. All these schools know that they came in and told us that they needed these smaller class sizes. Our consultants actually argued with the committee that we didn't need to go that low, and we all made a policy decision back then that we needed to have those smaller class sizes. So this has been on the table, proposed to the recalibration committee 5 years ago, that this is what they needed. So this isn't a surprise that now that this most recent recalibration committee has this working on, because they didn't do it. They came to us, they said, we got to have this. We did everything, all the funding that goes through the model hinges off that class size for the ADMs and everything else. They knew it was there. They were drawing the money on it. Now all this recent committee's done is said, let's hold their feet to the fire and make them do what they asked for. I'd urge that you defeat this amendment.
Any other discussion? Senator Nicholas, go ahead for your final time.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. You know, this would have been a better discussion had the standing committee not already gutted it. The standing committee took the House's language and they put in, maintains an average student-teacher ratio. So that if you're Cheyenne or Casper, you get to average all your numbers. So you could have 30 in one school and 10 in the other. Though that doesn't work the average right, but I mean, you could, as long as you've got a small classroom and a large. Now, the problem you have in Laramie, and I think it's probably true for all large districts, is that the town is moving one direction. And where that new school is, they're inundated with kids, and then they're moving away from older areas, and they have smaller student population. Now, the question is, if you're going to adhere to the 16, which I think I could get there, then fair enough, you start busing from one school over to the other. And if the standing committee had kept that language in, you'd be hearing from your big districts right now to saying, look, you're going to require us to bus half the kids from one side of the town to the other. So the standing committee, our committee, says to everybody, well, let's just allow it to average. So if you're a big district, you're okay. But if you're a small district and you've only got two elementary kids or schools and you've got the 17-14 situation, you're going to have to bus two kids. And you can't use any innovation with respect to those two, use an instructional facilitary, a paraprofessional, or somebody to come in and offset that number so you don't have to ship two kids. So if we were sitting here and talking about the House's language, fair enough. We would mandate every class at 16. But the existing language doesn't do that. And part of the problem is that I see is if we're going to do 16, let's do 16 and let's strip off the standing committee amendment and go back to 16. Now, if you do that, we may have a bill to write. And that bill, the check we're going to have to write is building more schools because we may not have enough classrooms to do that. And if we're going to say we're going to build brand new schools each and every time, unless you get an exception, well, now the exceptions process is flawed because who do you go to? You go to the state board of education that's not elected group. They're appointed, and I submit to you that's not their role. And I don't know whose role. If you could send it to an elected state superintendent, but who should have the role to make exceptions to this? And if it's on extraordinary conditions, what is extraordinary? It's not extraordinary if we have to go out and build another building. You just come down to the Appropriations Committee, you say, give us another school. If we're not prepared to do that, then we need to have a plan. And the plan has to be, really, we've got to go back to the drawing board to say, at what point does it make a difference? And is student learning affected more by being bused versus having an instructional facilitator or a paraprofessional in that classroom? But I'm okay with sticking with the House language, and we'll pay the bill if that's what we want to do. Because I really do believe if we had all classes of 16, but if you're sitting out there in your community in Jeffrey City and you've got 18 kids or 19, I suppose you can ship those two kids off to Lander or Riverton, unless it's extraordinary. But I don't think busing is extraordinary. In fact, a lot of kids bus. I used to get bused from Lander out to Fort Washakie every day. And, it was only 35 minutes. No big deal. It's not very much fun when you're in third grade, but it's no big deal. You can live through it. Yeah, it explains a lot, doesn't it? But incidentally, so look, folks, we're not there yet. I think we ought to get there. There are other alternatives. I urge your support.
Thank you. Question before us is in regard to second reading amendment number 20 or number 3, House Bill 127. All those in favor of this amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
That amendment has passed. We are now back on the bill. Any further discussion on House Bill 127? House Bill 127 having been read two separate times, the question is, shall a bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, do we have a consent list on third reading today?
Mr. President, we do have a consent list. The consent list is as follows. House Bill 7, Veterinary Medical Practice Act 2. House Bill 8, Traditional Food Act. House Bill 20, Medicaid Reimbursement of Services. House Bill 50, Health Insurance Exchanges. House Bill 80, Service of Process in Family Violence and Stalking Cases. House Bill 81, Vacant Land. House Bill 88, Guides and Outfitters. House Bill 99, Substance Abuse Treatment Funding Awards. House Bill 158, Rule Against Perpetuities. House Bill 217, Production States Agreement. And House Bill 246, National Guard Disposal of Land.
Would anyone like any of these bills removed from the consent list? Seeing none. Having been read three separate times, the question is, shall these bills pass the Senate? House Bill 7, House Bill 8, House Bill 20, House Bill 50, House Bill 80, House Bill 81, House Bill 88, House Bill 99, House Bill 158, House Bill 217, and House Bill 246. Chief Clerk will please call the roll.
Martin. Bebout?
Aye.
Burns?
Aye.
Case?
Aye.
Christensen?
Aye.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
Dockstader?
Aye.
Driscoll?
Aye.
Emmerich excused. Esquibel?
Aye.
Geis?
Aye.
Hastert?
Aye.
Hicks?
Aye.
Hines?
Aye.
Jennings?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Landon?
Aye.
Martin?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
Nicholas?
Aye.
Nutting? Perkins,
aye.
Peterson,
aye.
Ross,
aye.
Rothfuss,
aye.
Schiffer,
aye.
Scott,
aye.
Von Flatern,
aye.
President Anderson.
Aye.
On the consent list, 29 ayes, 1 excused. House Bill 7, are there any changes? Case, aye to no. Closing vote. Closing vote closed. House Bill 7, 28 ayes, 1 no, 1 excused. House Bill 8, are there any changes? Case, aye to no. Barnard, aye to no. Johnson, aye to no. Rothfuss, aye to no. Ross, aye to no. Esquibel, aye to no. Closing vote. Closing vote closed. House Bill 8, 23 ayes, 6 noes, 1 excused. House Bill 20, are there any changes? Closing. Schiffer, aye to no. Case, aye to no. Perkins, aye to no. Closing vote. Closing vote closed. House Bill 20, 26 ayes, 3 noes, 1 excused. House Bill 50, are there any changes? Jennings, aye to no. Case, aye to no. Closing vote. Closing vote closed. House Bill 50, 27 ayes, 2 noes, 1 excused. House Bill 80, are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing vote closed. House Bill 80, 29 ayes, 1 excused.
House Bill 81, are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. House Bill 81, 29 ayes, 1 excused. House Bill 88, are there any changes? Case, aye to no. Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. House Bill 88, 28 ayes, 1 no, 1 excused. House Bill 99, are there any changes? Schiffer, aye to no. Case, aye to no. Driscoll, aye to no. Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. House Bill 99, 26 ayes, 3 noes, 1 excused. House Bill 158, are there any changes? Scott, aye to no. Bebout, aye to no. Jennings, aye to no. Ross, aye to no. Hines, aye to no. Coe, aye to no. Perkins, aye to no. Meyer, aye to no. Dockstader, aye to no. Barnard, aye to no. Esquivel, aye to no. Driscoll, aye to no. Case, aye to no. Johnson, aye to no. Landon, aye to no. Cooper, aye to no. Burns, aye to no. Peterson, aye to no. Christensen, aye to no.
Anderson, aye to no.
President Anderson, aye to no. Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. House Bill 158, 9 ayes, 20 noes, 1 excused. House Bill 217, are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. House Bill 217, 29 ayes, 1 excused. House Bill 246, are there any changes? Case, aye to no. Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. House Bill 246, 28 ayes, 1 no, 1 excused.
Having received the affirmative vote of the majority of the members elected to the Senate, House Bill 7, House Bill 8, House Bill 20, House Bill 50, House Bill 80, House Bill 81, House Bill 88, House Bill 99, House Bill 217, and House Bill 246 have passed the Senate. House Bill 158, having failed to receive the affirmative vote of the majority of the members elected to the Senate, House Bill 158 has failed to pass the Senate. Any other bills? Consideration of bills on general file, Senator Ross.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself into committee of the whole.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion has passed. Would Senator Esquivel please approach the desk?
Committee of the Whole will please come to order. The first bill for our consideration is House Bill 36. The reading clerk will read the House Bill.
House Bill 36, Cancer Control Act,
Amendment an act relating to the Wyoming Cancer Control Act, sponsored by Representative Escobel.
You have heard the reading of the bill? What is your pleasure?
Senator, I have to read that. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Martin, Nutting, Schiffer. No, Senator Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott. Senator Langdon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, prior to morning, I will certainly stand up and support this bill. As you know, this bill relates to our colorectal cancer screening test that the Senator County works so hard to put in place.
The guts of the bill is on page 2. And you see the new language there. The department on a case-by-case basis may authorize follow-up screening when medically indicated. Folks, what the situation is that we're getting some of our underprivileged in to get these colorectal exams, and rather than just saying something is found, rather than just telling those folks, hey, it's good of you to come in, we've taken care of the first test, but you're on your own now. I feel like this is a good bill for us to go in and say, look, on a case-by-case, if it's a situation where an individual has to go back in for a rescreening, and we know that takes place, I can speak from experience, it does take place, you need to go back in. I think it's still appropriate for us to cover some of those exams. So that's the essence of the bill. I think it's a good bill, and I'd ask for your support.
Any other discussion, questions? Senator Bebout?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, too, would ask the body to support this bill. There's been a lot of progress made over the last decade
in colon cancer, and the main reason we've had such progress is because of the checkups and the colonoscopies. And certainly if you go in there and you see a polyp, and you're able to remove that and determine whether it's benign or malignant, that's a huge thing. These polyps do occur, and people that may, in fact, have a polyp removed, 10 years later, they could have a reoccurrence of that polyp, and it's certainly better to find out earlier than later. So I would ask that you support this bill.
Senator Jennings?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question to the sponsors and supporters of this, if the state pays for the first test, you find something, that's great. You probably have saved a life. But then you have, depending on what the doctor tells you, you have 5 years or 10 years you have to return for the follow-up test. Isn't that enough time to save a little bit of money so you have some skin in the game also?
Senator Nichols.
Following up on that, there are a lot of folks that find themselves in a risk group where the recommendation is an annual review. And these are expensive. I mean, they're a couple of grand a piece, sometimes as high as $3,000 a piece. And you could find yourself in the recurrent position for a number of things. If you have any type of colon issue, if you have colitis, you have a variety of things that don't even address the polyps issue. So my question, first of all, is that, this has been, folks, a very expensive program on the order of $3 to $5 million a year, I want to say. And I don't see a fiscal note here. I mean, we know that there's a percentage of the population that you were to go out and screen would be recommended for annual checkups, every 2 year checkups, and every 5 year checkups. So what's the price tag on this? Why don't we see a fiscal note on it?
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, the reason you don't see a fiscal note is the department has not been competent in managing the existing program, and there, what's the problem is, the screenings, when done, are, near as I can tell, well done and effective. Now, they're not perfect. They're about 90% effective. That's the nature of the thing. But the department has not been effective in outreach and getting the word out to people that this program is available. And so they are not anywhere near reaching the population that we should be. And I was a no vote in committee on this bill. And the reason is that I recognize there are going to be some individuals who are, the medical indication is that in 3 or more likely 5 years, they're going to need a rescreening based on what was found on the first screening. And I have felt that, well, these are, they can go back, they can save up, they can take steps. They know they are at risk. They can take steps to get the necessary screening. But we need to do a better job of reaching the larger population, Mr. Chairman, that has, for in good part, financial reasons, not gone and got this kind of screening, and the department has not been effective at that, with the result they have the surplus money in their existing budget to pay for this. And I think we'd be better off getting a better outreach job out of the health department on the existing program before we go into this kind of expansion. But, Mr. Chairman, that's a matter of judgment for the Senate, because there's no question that in a number of these cases that the rescreening is needed. It is going to cost, the cost will vary quite a bit depending on what they find, although they've been able to negotiate a pretty good deal, the department has, on these. But it is going to be a costly rescreening. It will certainly make it easier for the individuals involved if the state will pick that up. But I think we're better off concentrating on a better outreach on the existing program and spending our money there rather than going in to this. And there is surplus money because they haven't been doing an effective outreach job.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I want to make sure that I understand, because when you see on page last day, the department said no fiscal impact.
Certainly this has a fiscal impact. If the department says we have too much money in a particular program and therefore we can continue to utilize that money, that is a fiscal impact. Now, there's two ways to deal with this. On one way, you send it back to the Appropriations Committee and say, look, find out what the real fiscal impact of this bill is. But, folks, there is a fiscal impact. And it's not a good answer at any given time to say, well, it turns out that in this line item of the budget, we've got an extra $500,000. And so while there's a fiscal impact, there's no appropriation needed to address it. When you vote on a bill, you should know how much money is in this program, how much are you using, and are you going to use more of these dollars? But you know these are not free procedures. You know they're on the order of $2,000 to $3,000 a pop. You know there are a group of folks that are going to get an annual recommendation because of their condition. And there are people that will have 2 and 3 years. And you know that the people that are most likely the candidates to use these are the ones that are probably using the system because they know they have some existing health conditions. So, you know, it's a concern to me. I don't think we're late in the game. You know that putting it back in the Appropriations Committee is the death knell to this. But there is a fiscal impact. And I'm very bothered by an agency that says there's no significant fiscal impact. There is a significant impact. There may be no need for an appropriation. They can do the statistical analysis of how many people are going to require multiple procedures and what's the price going to be.
Senator Scott.
what you're saying is what's wrong with our fiscal impact program.
No impact. If an agency is against a bill, the fiscal impact stretches to the chandelier. We don't get straight answers on these things, and there's a whole series of reasons for it. I can assure you they don't need an appropriation. They should, if they'd run the program right, but they don't.
Senator Nutty?
Bill and ask for its passage. The purpose of this bill is to prevent colorectal cancer. And it's like we identify some people out of a population that are at risk. If we then don't do anything about those that we have identified as being at high risk, it defeats the purpose of doing the screenings to start with. In order to meet that goal of preventing colorectal cancer, we need to follow up on those high-risk individuals that are identified. Otherwise, there isn't that much benefit in identifying them.
Senator Bebout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Chairman appropriated.
Correct. There is a fiscal note that should be on here because it does have a potential impact. But I would submit to you that when we did the budget bill last year, the Appropriation Committee looked at this particular program and allocated the money they thought necessary. Let's look at what this bill does. What it's saying is that if someone, in fact, has a high probability of contracting colon cancer and the doctors recognize that and they're saying, we ought to have another look at you later, that may be a higher priority than someone out there that may want to have the screening that just for whatever reason, their family history, whatever, thinks they may want to do it. So what we're talking about here is putting people into the system that have a higher probability of getting cancer. I will tell you, Mr. Chairman, that if you look at the fiscal note long-term to us, and if you look at those that may come in under Medicaid and someone contracting colon cancer, not only is the risk of life very high and the loss of life, but also the cost. And I can't tell you right now what a complete... If you have a surgery to remove cancer of the colon, and you may have to have a colostomy and all those particular issues, what that cost would be to the state, but it's huge. So I would suggest that you vote for this bill. You know, absolutely that there will be a potential problem with this. Let's deal with it next time. Let's don't take away the rights from some people that may in fact need another colonoscopy because of their high degree of risk.
Senator Burns.
Every 3 years and check on it. So I understand the necessity for a program like this. However, it is well-intentioned. However, we know what kind of paving stones intentions make. And this is a poorly worded bill to a apparently shoddily run program by the Department of Health. And I'm really concerned about the idea of saying, oh yeah, let's just kind of, it's a good idea, it's a good intention. I think that the Department of Health should come back next year during the budget year and say, here's exactly what we think this is going to cost. And the good senator from Albany County is exactly right. There are millions of colonoscopies done per year. They have almost exact statistical analysis as to how many colonoscopies are going to result in how many positive results, how many heightened tendencies toward it. That's why they say some people, you come back 1 year from now, you come back 3 years from now. The Department of Health should have complete access to those statistics. They should come back and say, here's exactly how much we need for the 1 year, for the 3 year, and so forth. Instead of just saying, oh, we've got some extra money and we think this is a good idea, why don't you just authorize it for us?
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, after listening to the debate, I heard that you vote against this bill. This is complicated in a number of different ways. But one is that the well-intentioned program is identifying non-Medicaid or Medicare-eligible people. So the
you're already identifying a group of people that have their own resources and could probably afford but choose not to, and we're trying to encourage them into a program. If we've got them to the program and they realize that they're a high risk, they ought to then be using their own resources. Obviously, if they, because of their health conditions, they go into the Medicare or Medicaid program, then they would be covered for different reasons under different programs. But this is a, and I think I'm right, that this, with respect to, if you're Medicaid, you would be in a different eligibility. This wouldn't be, bill program wouldn't be necessary for you. And this is really a group of people that were not, either don't have insurance on the one hand and don't have a federal program to pay for them on the other hand. And they're the ones that are taking these dollars out. This is the way you get unintended consequences. We start a lot of programs, they get more expensive, and then we begin to load them up without understanding what the full impact is. Now, if the argument is that we can save lives, then I submit to you, go to the Department of Health and ask them, if we're going to put $2 million into a program today, choose the program for us where most lives would be saved, and I don't know if this would be it. There are a whole bunch of other screening programs that we could pay for people who are uninsured and who are not either in the Medicaid system or in the Medicare system. There are a lot of other things that we could do today to improve the life, the quality of life, and the longevity of people. And I'm not certain this is the program that is the highest risk and where our dollars are best spent. And if we're going to get into that analysis, then let's go back to the Department of Health and say, we're prepared to put in $5 million, $10 million, tell me what it is, whatever your number is, and then invite the Department of Health and say, for those people who are not Medicaid eligible, who are not Medicare eligible, and who are have no insurance and whose income is, say, under 200% of the federal poverty guidelines, for that group of people, tell us what we could do to make their lives better or to extend their lives. And I would be willing to bet that this is probably not the program. There's probably some other programs that are even that would be even better programs to initiate.
Back to Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, the underlying program here is actually one of the most cost-effective in terms of lives saved from what I've seen in the analysis of getting the one screening in every 10 years. It does, the screening itself does usually, not always, but usually prevents the cancer. And when you look at it, it doesn't save as much money as the screenings cost, but it comes quite close. With the result, in terms of lives saved, the underlying program is fairly cost-effective. There are perhaps some other things. An effective tobacco cessation program, if it works, is probably more effective. If we would pass an indoor smoking ban and spend a little money enforcing it, that would be more cost-effective. Money spent enforcing a seatbelt ban is probably more cost-effective. But there aren't very many. However, the expansion of the program that this bill proposes, I'm not sure that rises anywhere near the same level of saving a life, because we have found that these people are at risk, and these are not the by and large, the totally destitute people that you would find, say, in a Medicaid program. Although, remember, Medicaid, not everybody's categorically eligible for. So some of the people could be. But people have quite an incentive to get that reprieve screening because they know they're at risk, which is not true of the population at large. So, Mr. Chairman, make no mistake about it, the underlying program is very cost effective, and the problem is lack of outreach to get as many people into it as should be.
That's Senator Langdon.
Appreciate all the comments from many of my colleagues, and I'll try to address a couple of things that have come up. First of all, the senator who helped to sponsor the legislation that created this program is exactly right. We've hit on a program that is absolutely saving lives. One of the problems with that initial piece of legislation, folks, in my opinion, is that we did not earmark monies for that outreach. If you think back to how that conversation went, it was all about getting the word out through our providers. And there are several of us in the information industry that know that it costs a lot of money to advertise and get the word out on programs like this. So the fact is, no, we have not shared enough information about this colorectal cancer program. Because we've relied on our providers for the most part to do that. Second of all, I'm not sure why there was no fiscal impact stated on this, but I suspect it's because we've already budgeted this amount. If we don't use that budgeted monies for first-time visits, then on a case-by-case basis, we may authorize somebody for a follow-up visit. Regarding whether or not they have enough wherewithal or can save the money themselves, what if they've got a follow-up screening in 1 year? Do we just tell them, well, good luck, we're not going to be able to pick that up? The senator from Fremont County is exactly right, folks. This is a cost saver and it's a lifesaver, and I think this is a good bill. I encourage you to pass it.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I think that deserves some discussion with respect to how we budget items. If you have, suppose you have $5 million in your budget for a program, and the agency is only using $4.5 million, the $500,000 reverts at the end of the year and goes in the general fund, and we spend it next year when we come back. So now you say to the agency, why don't you increase the size of your program? We don't know how much it's going to cost you, but go ahead and increase it. And the first year, a couple things could happen. One is the word doesn't get out, and nobody uses these follow-up programs. And the next year, you find out you need $10 million. The agency says, hey, you didn't ask us what it's going to be next year. We just assumed that this is the program you wanted, so now you need $10 million. Well, now the Appropriations Committee is required to fund the $10 million. Why? This goes back to that old zero-based budgeting issue. You think, well, we go in and we decide the programs. That's not the case. The legislator decided the program this year. Once you put this into law, your expectation is that next year, the Appropriations Committee will fund the program you enlarged. So next year, they come back, and now it's a $20 million bill, and it's our job to fund it. Now, we can come in and propose new legislation to remove that obligation. Imagine what, if you think it's hard to vote no now, imagine what it's like to say, well, wait a minute, I didn't know it was going to be that expensive. Now, another thing that can happen is they were wrong. Or they actually knew they were wrong, and as the good gentleman of Trona County said, they decided to understate it, to say there's no fiscal impact. And they come in and they have now a demand for, you had $5 million in the budget, now it's a demand for $10 million. What happens? Well, the first 5 million people, which may be not your brand new members, the first 5 million, they get their procedures done. And then you have an unfunded need, and they just stop it, and they say it's over now. And then they come back, the legislature says this was a hot program, and it was a great program, and we need another $5 million. But the idea, they say, well, they may have excess funds in their budget for other things. There's a lot of excess money in there. And when you look at your goldenrod, there's about 25, as high as $70 million that comes back at the end of every year,
and it's built in the goldenrod. If you want to spend reversions, that's fine, but it's very dangerous practice to go down and spend reversions. I'd urge you to vote no.
Any other question being called? All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion to adopt the... All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 36, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Chair is in doubt. All those in favor? All those opposed?
I don't know if there's enough people here.
14. House Bill 36 has failed to pass the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our roll call. Have a roll call. Sorry. Having failed a standing roll call, we'll have a roll call at this point.
Barnard? Bebout? Burns?
No.
Case?
No.
Christensen?
Aye.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
Dockstader?
Aye.
Driscoll? Emmerich excused. Esquibel?
Aye.
Geis?
No.
Hastert?
Aye.
Hicks?
No.
Hines?
No.
Jennings?
No.
Johnson?
No.
Landon?
Aye.
Martin?
Aye.
Meyer?
No.
Nicholas?
No.
Nutting?
Aye.
Perkins?
No.
Peterson?
Aye.
Ross? Rothfuss?
Aye.
Schiffer?
Aye.
Scott?
No.
Von Flatern? President Anderson.
Aye.
Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. 15 ayes, 14 noes, 1 excused.
House Bill 36 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for your consideration.
I did.
That was 14-13, wasn't it? 14. Ayes. 15-14. House Bill 36 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 39. Reading clerk will read the House Bill.
House Bill 39, Health Litigation Fund, an act relating to the administration of government and national health care reform, sponsored by the Labor Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Nutting, and Scott. No, Senators Martin and Schiffer, Senator Scott, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriation, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do not pass. Aye, Senators Hastert, Nicholas, Von Flatern. No, Senators Meyer and Peterson, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
You have read the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Scott.
Those have been well handled elsewhere. Right now, the score is 50-50. half the district judges that have heard the cases have said it's perfectly constitutional, and half of them have said it's perfectly unconstitutional, and we're going to find out. And they're really contesting just one piece of the national reform, the individual mandate. Some of the rest of it may go because it wasn't a severability clause, and we don't know, and we won't know on that for some time. It's being well handled. We got into the case and relatively on the cheap, and that's fine. What this bill does is takes a look at reality and says that in that enactment, and there's more than one, there's a series of pieces of federal legislation that are all really part of the national reform effort. There are several hundred, and Mr. Chairman, I've lost count of how many hundred there are, rulemakings in there. And some of those are going to be sensible, unexceptionable. They'll follow the law. There won't be any problem with them. And some of them, Mr. Chairman, in the nature of things, are going to be quite adverse to our interests here in Wyoming. Some of them have tremendous potential for that. There's a minimum benefit package design that I don't envy the Health and Social Services in Washington on that one. They're going to hear from every special interest in the country as to why their particular provision has to be in that minimum benefit design. There's regulations on insurance exchanges we've talked about here, may or may not fit Wyoming. There's lots of these regulations, and the trouble is going to come in some of the places. The bureaucracy is going to go well beyond what's in the law and impose solutions, some of which will not be in our interest. And that's where we can really do some effective legal work in fighting the bad features of the reform. And that's what this is all about. We don't have, Mr. Chairman, the kind of expertise within our Attorney General's office, and the appropriations keep their budget tight enough so they're pretty well busy anyhow. We may need to go out and get some outside legal counsel in dealing with some of these issues, some of which can get quite esoteric. That federal law is not easy to deal with. I tell you, reading, Mr. Chairman, reading any recent federal enactment in the health and social services area, any in the past 10, 12 years, makes you really appreciate the quality of work that we get here through our legislative service office, having a decent set of bill drafting standards and using them. Because the feds don't have that benefit, and the result is an awful mishmash. So it gets, Mr. Chairman, quite complicated. This is a matter the committee was proceeding along these lines. The governor picked up on it and, or independently concluded the same thing. So this is something that if you think back to his State of the State, he was pushing. And we need to have a fund so that as the rulemakings start taking place, and I think most of them will take place in the next year, year and a half, we'll see the key ones. We need to have the ability to go forth and dispute the ones that are going to be harmful to us here in Wyoming. Key provision here is on page 2, lines 18 through 24. This is in the things can account can be used for. Litigation activities that may lead litigation, including legal comments on proposed federal regulations, et cetera. That's the heart of this bill. Yes, it authorizes expenditure on constitutional issues because we may hit one of these, but this is really aimed at the regulatory efforts that we're going to see an overwhelming number of in the past and in the next year, year and a half. Mr. Chairman, as introduced, the appropriation was $2 million. It got cut down in the engrossed version here. It's $500,000. I discussed that with the governor's office, and it was their feeling that since we would be back here a year from now, litigation would be just really getting going at that point, that this was enough to carry them to that stage, and they could be back and ask for more if they needed it. So they were all right with that. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the substance of the bill. It goes in, authorizes those things. It says you've got to take into account the kind of things you've got to take into account when you consider litigation. You know, what's the chance going to be successful? I'm looking at page 4. What's it going to cost? What's the chance you can get a favorable outcome negotiated, et cetera? Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions. It's a good bill.
Mr. Vice President Nicholas.
Apparently, you're just not quick enough. Mr. Chairman, the Senate Appropriations Committee recommended a do-not-pass for this bill for a couple reasons. First of all, recognize that there's a difference between the Attorney General appearing as an amicus writing a brief and just appearing on behalf of somebody in that sense. There's a second issue is when does the state intervene in a lawsuit? And then if that intervention takes place, does it take place in a state lawsuit? So the Wyoming attorneys are perfectly capable and licensed to enter into any state lawsuit if they wanted to do so. If they want to intervene in a federal lawsuit that exists around the United States, then our lawyers can also appear in those federal cases. If there is a case in a state court in some other state, they may not be able to enter their appearances without having local counsel. We didn't necessarily hear the testimony from the governor or anyone else that they needed this kind of money. During the appropriations process, the number of less than $10,000 came up, and those dollars are made available through the budgeting process. With respect to this proposed legislation, it proposes to create a new statutory account to be put into statute as opposed to simply appropriating money. What we submit to you is that if at this point it looks like all the needs of this the state, well, first of all, the testimony was that most likely if there's going to be any intervention, it would be through the amicus process, the Attorney General simply appearing and writing briefs, and we do have counsel that are coming up to speed. The AG office should become experts in this area, and it's our expectation that as needs change, they will take lawyers and train them in this area. It's not a big deal. You start sending them to continuing legal education. You start getting them prepared. We think there is a need to put an attorney in the AG's office, assign them to this area of law, and we expect that it's going to be done. But to go out and create a new statutory account, put $500,000 into it, there's simply no need at this point. If the AG needs money, they have a litigation fund, they have contingency funds, the governor has contingency funds. All of that can be addressed in the existing budget. There's no need to create a brand new statutory account and put $500,000 into it at this time. So our recommendation is that the budget process works. The money that was requested by the governor has left our office, and the new governor did not specifically request this. To the extent they did ask for funds, they were received or appropriated through. So we think it's just we understand the idea and the intent is simply not necessary.
Senator Schiffer.
To rise to question this bill, first of all, and I happen to sit on that committee. The governor did not come to the committee and ask for the money. And there's a good reason for that. We already fund in the governor's office his health policy analyst. That person is very well paid, very knowledgeable, and that's what that person is there for. We've seen what happens next is if there's a policy in this area, a rulemaking, if you will, then the governor stands up and says, hey, we're going to oppose that rulemaking. And he writes letters, and he goes and testifies and does his governor-like thing. That's how you affect federal rules. And it works. And we have funded that fully. Second thing, in terms of the Attorney General's office, they don't need the money. They've got $19 million in their litigation account. That doesn't count all the other people that run around in those offices. This is to go sue people and get amicus briefs and all those things. They're very well funded. Briefi. They're very competent. This is money that isn't needed. Let the process work. There was no request from the AG saying we need supplemental aid or we need somebody specially trained in this. That's not what they need. They're handling it. They're doing a very good job. I think we're winning. It's a 2-2 tie. That should tell us something. Second thing is the governor does have in his budget a contingency account, and he can shift money if he wishes to focus on the health area, and governors have done that, and this governor may or may not choose to do it. Let him go do it. And a year from now, actually less than a year from now, we'll start talking about the budget for the next biennium. These lawsuits go on forever, and we can sure handle it down the road. This is money that we don't need spent. Let the process work. Don't step outside of it with special legislation that was not requested. Don't step outside and pass something like this. I urge you to vote no.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as a dissenting opinion on the Appropriations Committee, Mr. Chairman, we did hear a lot of testimony about what would happen in the case of trying to sort through it's going to be just an amazing amount of rules and regulations that's going to come down from the federal government on this particular piece of legislation. If you think the thousands of pages of the Health Care Act are going to be an enormous amount of paper and trees killed, just look. Wait till the rules and regulations, because I don't know what the ratio is, but it's probably 5 or 10 to 1 for every page that you get from a federal act. You get at least 5 or 10 pages, or maybe 100 pages of rules and regulations. It's going to be more, frankly, than what our health policy analysis is going to be able to tackle by themselves at the governor's office. That individual has their hands full and their plate is full right now, irrespective of trying to follow this massive federal undertaking of taking over the healthcare industry of the nation and of Wyoming. And I think it's certainly appropriate to have the paltry sum that's available in this bill as a contingency account. There's other things that governor uses the contingency account for, things like natural disasters and different things like that. Although there's a lot of flexibility through the B11 process to get funds, this is one way that we can keep an eye on how much money we're actually spending, because they'll have to account what they're actually spending this money for. We'll know it's spent for healthcare litigation expenses and looking at the rules and regulations that are coming down the pike. And this I think is an appropriate amount. Folks have been looking at $2 or $3 million is what they thought they might need. I think they're kind of overshooting the mark on that one. This is a reasonable amount. We can come back here in a year and we'll find out whether or not we were wrong or whether we were right on this amount. And if there's money in this account and things haven't proceeded to the point of litigation and we don't see anything on the horizon, then this is a nice little coffee can that we can use it for something else. So I ask you that you put this money aside, and they'll use it wisely.
This is for lawyers. This is for
lawyers. I'm for
it. Senator Schiffer. Mr. Chairman, thank you. Let me point out there is no reporting requirement in this legislation at all. And what's more, this money is not, it's not going to fund a permanent position. The way this bill is written, it reverts a year from now. This is, and I don't know what he'll use it for, and we'll never know, because he's not obliged to report it. But you're not going to create expertise with a one-time, one-year appropriation. It's just not the way it's done, and it's unnecessary. With a $19 million account, I don't know what lawyers are worth, certainly more than a dime a dozen, but not much. He can go... He'll O'Hara. Apologies to my neighbors here, if they're worth more. But he certainly, in his $19 million, can go hire, if needed, an expert lawyer in this field. But like I say, if we just keep on doing what we're doing, we're winning 2-2. So I urge you to vote this bill down. Do not spend money we don't need to spend.
Senator Scott.
We're not winning 2-2. The states that brought the constitutional challenge, 50-50, it's going to wind up in the Supreme Court, I think. But that's not going to affect the great mass of the federal reform. The constitutional issue is independent of the heart of that bill. And the key point here is that this is not going to be business as usual. The next year or two, you're going to see a massive flood of federal regulation. Now, the existing appropriation for litigation is based on historical experience, you know, all the things we get into, water law, and criminal matters probably, a whole series of civil matters. People sue us over the regulations, sue the state agencies over regulations. What this is saying is we're going to be hit with an extraordinary deluge, Mr. Chairman, of new regulations. Now, you can take the point of view, it's business as usual, the feds will tell us what we got to do, and all we got to salute and do is salute and do it. I take the point of view, no. These are going to do us considerable harm. It's time to fight back effectively. And I don't think a lot of this is going to be intervention in other people's suits. I think that a lot of this is going to be the state saying to the feds, you do that and we will sue you. And we will refuse to implement it. And we will seek to enjoin you from cutting off our funds in retaliation and the things that they may do. Don't underestimate what's coming at us in the next couple of years as we struggle against this horrendous piece of legislation. You can say, business as usual, we'll just vote it down and go on. And I trust the governor will get rid of some of the less needed local litigation and roll over to some suits maybe he shouldn't. I think this thing is needed. And if the feds are all benign and nothing happens, then it won't get spent and it'll revert and that'll be fine. That's one reason you put it in a special account. So that'll happen. So I would urge that we do pass the bill. It's not a large sum, but it's sufficient to fight the worst of the harm that's going to come at us.
Mr. Vice President Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I should probably declare a conflict because having these lawyer counts are probably good for lawyers out there. But having said that, I thought the analogy to the water account, to defending our water, was probably a good one because we could talk about how we do it in the water process. There is no statutory fund to pay lawyers and litigate for water litigation. And yet we know in many instances we have to spend great resources to protect our water rights throughout various drainages. And what happens is that the Attorney General, along with the state engineer, sit down and make a budget, and they bring back a budget, and we fund the budget, and we have debate on it. And in those instances where we can't anticipate what the funding is for the following year, then we have a contingency account that's created in the governor's office and one in the attorney general's office for a variety of issues. And the governor also has what's called a B-11 process. A B-11 is simply a form called the B-11 form. And with that B-11 form, he can move monies around within the agencies to meet needs. And on any given month, there may be 15, 20, as high as $50 million B-11 back and forth among agencies, an extraordinary amount of money that's moved around to deal with these kind of issues. And I should make one of those forms available for particularly the new people so they could see what how much money gets moved around, incredible amount of money. And so the issue here partly is do we create a separate statutory account for this litigative process and make this different and elevated above all other statutory processes? And I submit to you, one is it's not necessary. We create non-statutory funds, if you will, all the time. We created a non-statutory fund not too long ago with the project for municipal waste dumps. We just create a fund and put the money in it. We have planned for these issues, and it seems to me that saying, notwithstanding the governor that you didn't come and ask us for money, here's $500,000, and we think, the governor, you're not doing enough. Go out and spend some more money. I think that's the message you send. We think you need to be proactive. You ought to be hiring these lawyers. Finally, this is a unique area in that, unlike water law, where the only people that know Wyoming water law are generally Wyoming people and Wyoming lawyers, and we need to develop that expertise. In the area of health care, it seems to me, you have an enormous wealth of private individuals, private interest, public interest, and the minute a regulation comes out, we all know about it because there's enough special interest out there watching both sides that they can ship the information out, and it's relatively easy. While the volume may be great, I agree that the volume may be great, the information is loaded out there because as soon as one of these regulations comes up, there are special interest groups that know about them immediately. They send the information out. And in most instances, an amicus brief is all that's going to require, a friend of the court brief to say, by the way, here's Wyoming joins this side of the dispute. So I really don't think it's necessary.
Question being, Senator Meyer.
Necessary. And folks, just a little bit about the B-11 process. If you want to try to follow the bouncing ball of the B-11 process, if you want to talk about smoke and mirrors and what happens in our budget after it leaves this floor, the B-11 process is really the definition of smoke and mirrors. I think we need something that's transparent. This is a contingency account. It will be transparent. We'll make sure there's reporting. And it'll do a good job. This thing is going to be more complicated than the tax code. And if you want to talk to your accountants about how complicated the tax code is, they don't know what it is, and they're professionals until they get some briefs from their professional people that tell them what the tax code is. So this is an entirely complex piece of legislation. It's going to have rules and regulations you can't believe, and we do need to stay on top of it, and our efforts need to be transparent.
Any other discussion? Question being called? All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 39. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no.
No.
The division being called? Those in favor, please rise. All those opposed? And roll call. Having failed, at this point, we'll have a roll call. Having failed the standing committee motion, a roll call vote is required. The chief clerk will call the roll. Thank you, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Barnard?
No.
Bebout?
No.
Burns. Case. Christensen. Coe. Cooper. Dockstader. Driscoll. Emmerich excused. Esquibel.
No.
Geis.
No.
Hastert.
No.
Hicks. Hines. Jennings. Johnson. Landon. Martin. Meyer. Nicholas. Nutting. Perkins. Peterson. Ross. Rothfuss. Schiffer. Scott. Bonflatern. President Anderson. Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. 10 ayes, 19 noes, 1 excused.
House Bill 39, having failed a roll call vote pursuant to Senate Rules 11-5A, is deemed indefinitely postponed. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 49.
House Bill 49, Primary Care Support Programs, an act relating to public health, sponsored by the Labor Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Dockstader, Martin, Nutting, Schiffer, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. The reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hastert, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, Von Fladeren, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, I move in the Committee of the Whole rise and report to do so with a recommendation that House Bill 49 do pass. There was a standing committee amendment. I ask to be read in at this time.
House Bill 49, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 1, line 1.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the standing committee amendment. Mr. Chairman, explain the bill just very briefly before we get to the standing committee amendment. What this bill seeks to do is deal with the problem we have got in this state of lack of health care providers, particularly primary care providers. We have a shortage. I can attest to it personally. When I was campaigning 2 years ago in one of the particularly in the newer neighborhood, in the Bar None community in my district, I met family after family who could not get a family doctor in Wyoming because of our shortage. There just simply aren't enough of them. And that's true all over the state. The people that are well established in the community tend to have a family physician they've found over the years. The newcomers often do not and have trouble finding one, because we have a shortage. What this bill does is it seeks to expand the number of community health centers. Mr. Chairman, the reason for doing that is the community health centers have two big advantages when it comes to recruiting particularly primary care physicians, and that's mostly what they employ. First, they are under the Federal Tort Claims Act, so they are not tied up in the problems with our tort liability system. They don't have to worry about malpractice insurance. Washington takes care of it. It's not a problem. Those doctors don't have to have malpractice insurance. They get covered by the feds. And that's very important, Mr. Chairman. The one we have in Casper has been able to recruit at times than nobody else in town could. Second, they get a special deal on reimbursement from Medicaid, which is our program, but it's a federal requirement, and they get a special deal, more importantly, Mr. Chairman, on reimbursement from Medicare, so they're better able financially to deal with some of the problems. And that helps their recruiting. Okay, the testimony, Mr. Chairman, we had in the Joint Interim Committee was these things, once you get them up and get them going, they should be self-supporting. They'll have a federal grant to help take care of some of the totally indigent people they serve, but they should be self-supporting. The special deal from Medicare, the special deal from Medicaid, the private business they can get, the arrangement they have in getting prescription drugs, all of them help fund it. So once you get them going, they should be self-supporting. What they need, Mr. Chairman, is capital, startup money. Get the people in, recruit them, pay their salary while you're building the patient base, which doesn't take very long, but it does take some time, even with our shortages. Buy the equipment, sometimes get remodeled space, get additional space. There's a whole series of startup costs that you've got. And that's what this bill is aimed at. It is not an ongoing support program, Mr. Chairman. It is a one-time startup. And that's the big thing that the Standing Committee Amendment does, is it changes the language to delete language that suggests that it's a ongoing support program. That was not the intention, never was the intention. Deletes that language, emphasizes, if you look at on line 27, the Standing Committee Amendment, the grant shall be used for capital and its startup expenses only and shall not be used for ongoing operating expenses. That was the way the bill is written to start with, but we made absolutely certain of it in the Standing Committee by adding that language, added some language that the grant's awarded if the applicant demonstrates that the problem integrates with the rest of the health care. And then in the Standing Committee Amendment, Mr. Chairman, we've got an appropriation, came in with a $10 million appropriation. The engrossed version has a $3 million appropriation. The Standing Committee said, well, the $3 million isn't going to be enough to get the job done, Mr. Chairman. We ought to put some more in, so we said, let's have an additional $2 million in the standard budget next year. I thought a very creative solution from one of our committee members that has a certain amount of appropriations training. Sometimes that training is good and sometimes it's bad. In this case, it was good. And we had a very creative amendment. Mr. Chairman, that's what the Standing Committee Amendment does. I urge its adoption and be happy to answer any questions on the Standing Committee Amendment.
Any questions? Senator Burns.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering if we could get a little bit more detail on the first few lines of the Standing Committee Amendment, where a process for facilitating capital construction and startup costs. Is that in reference to the idea of building new buildings or of rehabbing already existing buildings?
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, where they need to build a new building, that's beyond the financial resources we're proposing here generally. So it's they've been creative, the ones that are starting up now. They get loans from the Department of Agriculture, U.S. Department of Agriculture, of all people, has a program that can be used. They get financing from other things. The testimony we had, this is more along the line of putting the equipment in the buildings. As you know, equipment for a medical office can be quite expensive. One of the things they can expand into is dental care. We have difficulties getting enough dental care. The feds do authorize that as an expansion. Testimony we had is it costs $250,000 to equip a dental office. And then you have recruiting expenses, even though, Mr. Chairman, these organizations have a better chance of recruiting than other organizations in Wyoming because of their advantages with being under the Federal Tort Claims Act. It's still a hard thing to do, and that's expensive. You need money there. You need working capital, all kinds of startup expenses. So it's more that sort of thing than building buildings. The buildings, you'd have to have a much bigger appropriation, and the bill has a limitation on how much can go to any one center in there to spread things around. So buildings are not what we're after by and large. It's remodeling, equipping, startup expenses. Mr. Chairman, I hope that answered the question.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question so I understand. We're on the Standing Committee Amendment. And in addressing that, the question I have is how much money is actually in the bill now? It appears that there's still $3 million, and at least at this point in time until we get to the Appropriations Committee. And then there's an additional $2 million for the next biennium. And my question there is, can we even do that? Can we bind a next legislature in that regard?
Senator Abiba.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to divide the amendment. And the first division would be page 1, line 1 through 44. The second division would be on page 2, lines 1 through 3, ending with law, period. And then the third division would be the $2 million for the primary care support account. I believe that's divisible.
So let's see if I have that correct, Mr. Bebout. That's the first division is from line 1 to line 44 on page 1, and line 1 through line 7 on page 2 would be the second division. Is that correct? Did I get that right?
Mr. Chairman, no. On the second page, the second division would be lines 1 through 3, ending with law, period, and then the third division would be starting with there is, and then continue until line 7.
Very well. Well, there's three divisions. First division from page from line 1 to line 45, page 1. Second division, line 1 to line 3, ending with the word law. And the third division is from there is on line 3 to the end of line 8. Is that correct? I rule that it's divisible, Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, if I understand what the three divisions are, my question is, can Division 2 stand on its own? I do not believe it can. As I read Division 2, that's starting on page 2, line 1, with the words, until July 1st, 2017, when any unexpended money, that division will not stand on its own, or I misunderstood the division, and I would request that you clarify what goes where.
Senator Scott?
I can get my pages to separate, I will. Mr. Chairman, that's on page 5, line 13. After Act, certain till July 1st, 2017, when any unexpected money to revert is provided by law. Mr. Chairman, that will stand on its own, because what we're saying here, the lead-in sentence in the bill is any unexpended monies in the account shall not revert, but shall remain in the account to be expended for the purpose specified in this Act. And then what the Division 2 amendment seeks to add is to insert the language until July 1st, 2017, which any unexpended monies shall revert as provided by law. So it will stand on its own, Mr. Chairman, and it does make a lot of sense to do it.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Any other questions on the division? As stated previously, chair ruled that the divisions, that the amendment was divisible, and there were no further objections. Are you ready? Are you ready for the question on Division 1? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Division 1 to Amendment Number 1, Senate File 49, has passed. Are there any questions on Division 2? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, Division 2 just puts a reversion date in. Because of the nature of this, where you're trying to give them help with capital and startup, those things, there's some uncertainty in the timing. It makes sense to have a longer reversion date, but you need to have a reversion date, which the bill, as it came to us from the House, did not.
Any questions? Question being called. All those in favor of Division Number 2 to Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 49, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? That amendment is passed. Are you ready for Division Number 3? Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like a little more discussion why we are now going to go into the next biennial budget.
Microphone.
No, sorry. Sorry, Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like a little more discussion why we are now going to go into the next biennial budget and stick $2 million into a program that I do support. I think we need to do it, but it's going to be in the standard budget request. We won't have an opportunity, the JAC. I just don't understand, A, why we're doing it, and B, why it's standard. And to me, if we're going to have a budget and we're going to look at this, then we ought to do it through the normal budget process and let the Joint Appropriations Committee do what they do with these kind of programs, that is, scrutinize them and see if we really need to move forward and how much we should spend for it.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, and I agree with my colleague from Fremont County, and that's exactly what this does. It's very customary. Sometimes we put a paragraph in an appropriation in a bill like this saying it will not fold into the standard budget. In this case, we said we're going to put $2 million into the standard budget. A couple things that does, that allows the Appropriations Committee, as they look at the budget for that agency, then go in and say, wait a minute, there's $2 million that was added here. What's it being used for? Well, theoretically, it's being used for this program. They can leave it in, or they can take it out. That's standard in the budget process. It's customarily done. It's just kind of a new twist. I thought we may catch that committee sleeping. Those lads rarely sleep, it turns out, particularly during their meetings. But anyway, this is customary. We have folded money into, and we have prohibited money from going in on a standard budget. Why is it important in the case of this program? My colleague from Natrona County mentioned that the actual program is administered through the Department of Agriculture, which is an interesting concept in and of itself. But it's a long, drawn-out process. And when I say that, the testimony in committee is that some of these entities working through the Department of Agriculture process have a 2.5, and 3-year investment in bringing together these programs. They don't happen overnight. They are difficult. The criteria is extremely high to show that you have the ability not only to operate one of these, but that it's done in a very safe, in a very modern, using the healthcare records and all those things. It is a difficult process. It won't come together in a year. It just simply cannot be done that quick. And that's why I'm saying put something in the standard budget. If Appropriations wants to pull it back out, they'll be looking at the health care budget during the regular budget process. They can always pull money out of a standard budget. That's what they do. I think this allows some assurance that at least we're going to look at the program going forward to provide health care, and particularly our rural communities, but really statewide. It's a good program. We need to nurture it and nurture it over the time we need. I ask for support of this amendment.
Senator, Mr. Vice President Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm against the
the without discussing the merits of the bill, the issue here now is, do we put $2 million into the standard budget that goes into the next biennium, and once it's in the standard budget, it then it rolls over to every other biennium after that. And the one of the focus issues is, if we're here trying to start up new programs or allow communities to start new clinics in each community, there's only a finite number that should be created at all. And it seems to me that you could sit down and say, okay, here's the number of clinics we are going to start, here's the budget for each one, and then set that dollars and close the door once we know that we've got an appropriate number established that can be supported without hurting the other institutions in the community. This is a process that's more appropriate for an annual review to require them to make a justification for new money as opposed to saying we've already justified it in the first bill. I urge that you vote no.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, for many of the same reasons that were just urged for no vote, I urge you to vote aye. This is basically it's a one-time deal. It stretches out over a finite period of time, and we'll either get the institutions we need going or we won't. It should not be an ongoing program. But it does make sense to stretch it out and to, instead of appropriating all the money up front this time, to put some of it in the next biennium. We looked, Mr. Chairman, in the Federal Reform Act, and the monies for this program are appropriated. They're not authorized. They're appropriated. So they're likely to continue to be there. Now, there's some chance the Congress will go in and pass a bill all the way through unappropriating them. I don't think that's very likely, but it's possible. So that's why you have it as an appropriation partly in the next biennium and something that's authorized. So if things go wrong at the federal level, the health department say the opportunity's gone away, and it doesn't make sense to have these startup monies anymore because we are dependent on the federal. If you don't get the federal sponsorship, you don't get the advantages of being under the Federal Tort Claims Act. And those are very important. So this is basically this one-time appropriation stretched out. The current period of opportunity looks like it runs to 2017. And then either you've got them or you don't, and we won't be back. So, Mr. Chairman, I would urge adoption of the amendment.
Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion to accept Division 3 to Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 49, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
The chair is in doubt. All those in favor. Please rise. All those opposed? Division 3 has failed. Are you ready for the question on Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 49?
No, you already did it.
We've done that one.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, let me just explain one further thing about the bill, because we've pretty thoroughly debated it. It does include, in addition to community health centers, it does include rural health clinics. These are where a community will go in, equip or partially equip a clinic in an effort to attract physicians or nurse practitioners to a community. They don't have all the recruiting advantages that the community health center does, but they're a lot less complicated and sometimes the better way for a smaller community to proceed. So I just wanted to make it clear that that was involved as well. Mr. Chairman, at this point, I think it would be appropriate to read in the committee number 2 standing committee amendment.
Will the clerk read standing committee number amendment number 2 to Senate File 49?
House Bill 49, standing committee amendment number 2 to engross copy, page 5, line 2.
Mr. Vice President Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move standing committee amendment number 2 to House Bill 49. The Senate Appropriations Committee recommended that we reduce the appropriation from $3 million to $1 million. And part of the reason that if you look at an existing map right now of these facilities that already exist around the state, if we're only talking about startup facilities, many of your communities already have free clinics that are being funded through donations, through local resources. There are a lot of these facilities already around the state. One of the things that we haven't talked about yet is the whole certificate of need process, and that is we don't have any mechanism, if you will, to make sure that we don't overpopulate these facilities around the state and ultimately take resources away from your existing hospitals, your existing clinics, your existing institutions. So as the state goes out and starts saying, well, here's $1 million for you to go start a new facility, and not only that, but to buy equipment, if you knew that that was only serving population, which is not presently being served, or that it's not a Medicaid population that's actually being served, and the resources are going to your local hospital or local physicians or ambulatory care unit, whatever you had, fair enough. But we don't know that, and I think the Appropriations Committee is very concerned that the reasons these don't exist everywhere, particularly some of your larger communities, is because this population is being cared for by the existing resources and facilities, and to create new facilities to then take a volume of care that's already paying. I mean, even if they're Medicaid dollars, if they're going to your hospital, if they're going to an ambulatory care unit, those dollars will now move to a new facility. And when they move, somebody's going to see that loss, because those dollars are being consumed right now and they're being housed in somebody's budget. So we think we ought to be very careful about going out and encouraging new institutions that ultimately compete with your existing dollars. We've got whether you call it a $1.2 billion budget or whatever you call it for Medicaid dollars, they're being utilized by somebody. And if you want to say, well, we want to take them from the hospital or one area and give it to another group, you need to be very careful about this.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With respect to the amendment, one thing that would help me understand whether to vote for or against this amendment would actually be a question if you could answer for the proponents of the bill, if we have underserved community defined and what that is, and also with respect to the on page 3, line 24, that as I understand it, this grant goes as long as they, as long as the requirement is that they would serve that underserved community for at least 3 years. If you could help me understand how that works, and how this. And whether or not the $3 million or the $1 million that we're talking about here in Standing Committee 2, if that can be parlayed into somebody opening up a doctor's office as long as they serve an underserved community for 3 years, and then all of a sudden they've got an office with a potentially substantial grant from the state that got them up and running.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, there is a definition. I've seen the maps that show what part of the state is theoretically underserved in the federal designation. I will represent to you that on the statistics, you can make a pretty good case that the whole state is underserved, that we have, particularly with primary care providers, we have a shortage, and it exists in our community. It exists in Bighorn County. It exists all over the state where there simply are not enough primary care providers.
I think I can get from the health department, get you the map if you're interested, on the underserved areas. The reason in the bill for the three-year provision was if one of these things is successful, they may get it removed from the three-year, from the underserved area. You get enough providers in to serve the area. So you don't want them to be permanently in an underserved area because of their presence. They make the area cease to be underserved. So that's why that was written the way it was. They have a permanent obligation to serve the Medicaid population. Mr. Chairman, with regard to the argument that you don't need this because of competition, Mr. Chairman, that's simply not the reality in Wyoming. It may be where you're close to Fort Collins and can drive there, you can escape the practical effects of we don't have enough physicians in Wyoming. But absent that, competition is not a problem. We've got, Mr. Chairman, in my community, we've got one of the largest one of these around. It doesn't benefit particularly from this bill because it's already established and going, and I don't see where it's going to be likely to get much out of this. And there was a fear that there might be competition when it first came in. It's proved to be a godsend because we don't have the medical community to serve that we need. With absent that community health center closed, we'd have a major crisis with people having to go clear to Colorado for primary care because we simply don't have the resources. And that's true all over the state. I think, yes, it may shift a few of the Medicaid dollars, Mr. Chairman, out of the hospital emergency room into a cheaper setting. And if we're watching out for our budget here, that's something we should welcome because it's a much cheaper way to meet that need. But frankly, the opportunity is right now with the federal money that's available. We need to take advantage of it right now. You pass this amendment, what you're doing is saying, we don't really think that provider shortage is a problem in Wyoming. I ask you to look at your own constituency and see what you think goes on there. It's a problem all over the state. You need to have the $3 million appropriation to have a good reach across the state. You pass this amendment, yeah, you're going to have one more somewhere and probably one more rural health clinic somewhere. It's a drop in the bucket. If we're going to do something meaningful, Mr. Chairman, to meet the very real needs that our constituents have for adequate health care services, you need to pass this bill. Even the $3 million, Mr. Chairman, is probably inadequate. I hate the way stuff in health care costs money, but it sure does. And there is an amendment coming, I think, that will help alleviate any competition concerns. But frankly, Mr. Chairman, with so much demand out there, they're not a concern. The people that need to worry about the competition are Fort Collins.
Senator Ruffus.
Ruffus. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a similar concern, and I'm trying to work this through, and I certainly support the concept of this and what it's trying to get as its objective, which is these clinics and places that are underserved. But when I'm thinking this through, and I'm thinking through the concept of an underserved community, let's say that this is a community that only has 80% of the capacity it needs. So there's a substantial amount of additional capacity that it actually needs. And then what we're doing to meet that additional capacity is effectively biasing the marketplace towards one facility. We're doing that by granting additional dollars that will allow for the construction of a facility that will then be able to operate at costs far less than the competition that are already there. So to meet that additional 20% need, you're skewing the marketplace substantially against the other 80%. So while I'm not against this in principle, as far as the objective, I'm not sure that this mechanism is playing fair. Basically, what it's doing is it's claiming the new winner. There is no way the other facilities that are in that area, even if it is underserved, are going to be able to effectively compete with the new facility, because it's going to have the tremendous advantage of having a grant-based existence as opposed to a market-based existence like the rest of them. And I'm not entirely sure whether I'm going to end up supporting this or not. I love the concept, and I think we need to follow through on this concept. So maybe we need amendments. I don't know, Mr. Chairman, but this is not there yet in my mind, Mr. Chairman, and I don't think we should be voting for it in its current form.
Well, Senator Meyer.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, there was indeed a lot of discussion about the potential of harm based on grants-based versus market-based. And the situation that, and there is a committee of the whole amendment that I think will ease everybody's mind, but I guess notwithstanding the passage of that, at this time I think we need to reduce the amount in the bill. Because I look at a situation where you have a small market, and if you bring in a grants-based clinic, then that clinic is going to compete. And there's some areas, and let's take Lusk, for example. And this is, I don't believe this is going to happen, but Lusk is barely getting along with the hospital and the clinic that they have there now, just on a shoestring. If the federal government and the state government said, okay, the best way to serve people in Lusk on the way they would look at the model of health care providers is to put in a brand new clinic. Well, that would certainly spell the death toll for everybody else that's in there. I don't believe that's the case in Lusk. The case in Lusk, I believe, is that they're trying to put in a dental clinic in the original existing clinic and increase the services that aren't provided. But we don't know that sitting on this floor. And hopefully we'll try to figure out how to get some local input into the process. And I think that if we get the local input into the process, maybe on second reading or third reading, there would be a level of funding that may be indeed higher than $1 million. But I think without any local input and any local oversight, frankly, I don't believe we should leave it to the federal and the state government to make up decisions at the local level. So I would ask that you would support the Appropriations Committee amendment at this time. And if we can get that local oversight at subsequently with amendments, then come back in and revisit the dollar amount that we might be comfortable with.
Senator Scott.
Respond to the questions from Albany County. Frankly, the experience in my community, which has, again, the largest of these in the state, it's an advantage to the other providers to have one of these. These clinics differentially take the people who won't pay their bills, who can't pay their bills, can't afford it. That's what they get the federal grant for. That's their mission, and they accomplish it. These clinics take eagerly your Medicaid clients where the state doesn't pay the full cost. So they are an advantage to the other providers. These clinics take up the slack. Most of the in our community, it's been as high as 40% market share on occasion. Not that the people with the good insurance particularly wanted to go to the community health center, they had no other choice because there weren't enough providers. And that's the reality of most of Wyoming. Most of us think of the trip to Fort Collins as a lengthy thing. It's not just driving 40 miles for most of us. And we have shortages. So I urge the defeat of the committee number 2 amendment. We need the funding.
Senator, Majority Floor Leader Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Initially, as I pondered this bill and looked at it, I didn't think I had a problem, but I do, and I want to just address it on the floor here because of the very nature of some ruling of our bar council with regards to voting against or voting on a bill that may have an adverse effect on one of your clients. I currently represent a primary care physician who is opening up his own practice here, and I've been heavily involved in all of that, and I know the kind of money that's being put up to get in and open up his own private practice. I am not sure if this bill affects or does not affect him, but on the basis of appearance, I wanted the Senate to know that I, as a result of that, will declare conflict from this point on.
Thank you, Mr. Majority Floor Leader. Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Nicholas's motion to adopt the Standing Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2 to Senate House Bill 49, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
That amendment is has failed. Division being called. All those in favor, please rise. All those opposed?
Nine.
That amendment is passed the Committee of the Whole. We have another amendment, the Standing Committee of the Whole amendment, number one to House Bill 49, and Senator Meyer.
I have to read it.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. We'll have the clerk read that amendment. Sorry.
House Bill 49, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 2, line 18.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Meyer?
I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 49 and ask for your favorable consideration. Mr. Chairman, we've already had a lot of the discussion about why an amendment like this is necessary. I'm not sure if this is the exact way to skin the cat, but what I'm trying to do here, Mr. Chairman, is try to give some local oversight. And so I say before submission to the department and following public notice and hearing, the applicant shall be approved by the Board of County Commissioners for the county in which the community health center or rural health clinic is located or proposed to be located. And, Mr. Chairman, I think this goes into the point where we were at that point in time, if there is some competition, some consideration, as the good senator from Cheyenne said, he doesn't know whether he's for or against this bill or whether he may or may not have a conflict, but he thinks he does. This would allow the county commissioners to sort those type of competition issues out at that time and to get that local community to buy in to these. I'm not so concerned with the existing facilities that are already there because they can apply for these grants, but where you have a new facility or a new clinic come into a town that may directly compete for the Medicaid patients in that particular town. I certainly believe that the argument that the good senator from Natrona County said, the indigent people who pay nothing, it will actually help the current providers because that's a way to siphon off those people who actually pay nothing and get them through the grant new facility. I think that's a reasonable expectation where that could be a positive benefit to current providers. But where you have a situation where the current providers, if there's not enough people actually coming through those doors, whether it's a local community hospital or whether it's a local provider that have their own private practice, if they actually need those Medicaid patients just to pay the operating costs or their overhead costs, then those discussions can be made at the local level. And I really don't want to have the federal government and the state government make decisions at our local level. I'd rather have the county commissioners or someone else make that decision and enter into those discussions about whether or not there is some undue competition or unfair competition, or whether it's competition that might adversely affect the current providers that are already there. And I think those discussions can be made in the county commissioner's room. And if there are some objections to these federal funds coming down to the local level, and those objections can be expressed then. Without any type of really review process, there just isn't any really review process in the bill for local people to address their concerns about undue competition. And this allows them the mechanism to do that. And I'd ask for your favorable consideration.
Senator Langdon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand the concern of my friend at the back of the room with regard to local competition, whatever. But I guess my concern with this amendment that I'd like a little more conversation on is in the situation where our county commissioners oversee the very facilities that we're pushing this 20 to 40% of our population to, and that's the emergency rooms. And that's a pretty lucrative business for those hospitals out there. We push them there. They inure to the benefit of the fact that we don't have facilities like this, and then we get billed at the state for lots more money. And that's part of what we're trying to fix with these community health centers, and I'm just not sure about the oversight of a group that may or may not be overseeing some of those facilities out there to which that will hurt. So just a concern.
Senator Coe.
Thank you. My problem with the amendment has to do with a county like my county, and we have two special hospital districts up there spread out across the county, and, you know, the hospital operation in my town is very vibrant. It's about a $70 million a year deal, 50 doctors on staff, but remember that there are special districts out there in these special hospital districts. They elect trustees, are allowed to levy up to 3 mils. So my concern is we're going to put this in the hands of the county commissioners when, in fact, you ought to be talking to the trustees of that particular hospital district. So that's my problem with the amendment. I urge you to defeat it.
Senator Scott.
Chairman, I thought this was a friendly amendment and it would be helpful because what it would do is guarantee significant local support. I think, by and large, without that kind of local support, they aren't going to get far enough to apply for the state funds. So I didn't see any harm to this, but apparently there's some circumstances where you get factions within the county competing against each other. But still, some mechanism for ensuring the local support. We've got the 25% local match they've got to raise in here. But in most counties, I would think that if there was good local support, the county commissioners would be all for this. I think in a number of cases, they may well be among the biggest proponents of these things. So it looked to me like it was a friendly amendment.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, against the amendment, it always bothers me when we say we're for local control here, but then we want to heap on more government oversight. And I can tell you, in our particular area, this is not necessarily a good amendment. We have rural health care districts scattered around the county, and then we have a county-funded hospital. And what I see this do is taking the authority away from those local communities to be able to provide those. And in some cases, they may already have a health care district where they're taxing themselves. And through the county hospital, it actually drives these decisions away from these local communities to be able to fund the health care. So I don't necessarily think this is a good amendment. I think it may be appropriate in some places, but in other counties. And I would just tell you, leave it up to local control. You practice what you preach. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Vice President, Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, this is sort of fascinating because as I see the interest of the county commissioners, if the county commissioners were to vote their wallet or their purse, they'd probably try to sort out what lowers their costs, and the areas where they have costs are involuntary commitments and health care for folks that are in their local jails. And at any given time, that's where they'll vote their purse. Now, I think the last comment was made is turn the control over to the local hospital board, because they're the ones that have the jurisdiction, and maybe they will vote for the interest that's best for the community because they're responsible for the health care. Now we're hearing we have different hospital districts in the same county, and you could set up one of these just outside the hospital districts. But as we go through this, I guess I too thought when I first read the amendment that it was a good amendment because at least there's some control that we're creating these institutions in a way that will not impair or harm hospitals that we're already funding, that we're paying taxes for, doctors that we're trying to recruit, their likelihood of success. But at least somebody ought to be watching that. I don't know who the right one is, and I'm not sure that the hospital board is the right person because they, too, have their own purse to work. So having looked at the odds are, unless somebody has a better idea, I'd say somebody needs to attend to this, and the county board of, the Board of County Commissioners probably is the entity that has the broadest view because notwithstanding that their principal concern is how do they lower their health care costs for their jails, they do represent the oftentimes let do the mill levy for the hospitals, and they at least have a countywide view of it. So I'd urge your support.
Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, on and forth. If this amendment is not passed, then what we have before us is a bill that the state and the federal government can come in a private physician, maybe from outside the area, could put up 25% and be subsidized and go into direct competition with your local clinic or your local hospital. And so this is the amendment that provides that local forum that you so desperately need. And that's just basically what it is. I mean, both sides could be heard at a hearing supervised by the county commissioners. Both sides could be argued. So that's what this amendment provides, is more local control. Without it, there is no local control. And I'd urge the body's favorable consideration for this amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other discussion? Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief. So no... This is the only thing between us and lunch, maybe. you never know. You never know about those majority floor leaders. On for this amendment, when I was a county commissioner, we had a lot of health care issues when I was on there. In fact, when I got hit by a truck once, I oftentimes wondered if that was a sign from one of the boring factions of a health care dispute in our community. But ultimately, when it comes down to it, and just to echo what the last speakers are, the county commissioners aren't a perfect choice for this, but I think that they are a pretty good choice. One of the things that you look at and what they represent, and I'm sure that what it does, if nothing else, it provides a unique local forum that hospital districts or rural health care districts or others can come in, and those competing interests, whether they're competing or whether they're allied, can come in, and it gives a local forum for that to happen, a hearing, a process, and the opportunity for public input about the advisability of applying for one of these things. And absent this amendment, there just isn't that opportunity at the local area. Now, you know, I guess you can have county commissioners gone wild and maybe they do things that aren't in the best interest of their community. I think, you know, if you go down into one of the southwestern portions of our state, there's been a significant and reoccurring shuffle among county commissioners, most related to issues regarding the hospital. And that's not uncommon. So I think that you're at an area where the county commissioners provide, one, a local forum for local interests, whether they're for it or against it, to come in and visit about that. And it also provides a certain amount of accountability, because we see oftentimes that the elections and health care issues at the county level oftentimes do result in commissioners being retained or others or not. And so I think that gives the public as much input and accountability in regard to this decision, where without something like this, you don't have that at all that I can see, other than the insulated nature of the Department of Health or the Department of Agriculture.
Question being called. Are you all those in favor of Senator Meyer's motion to adopt the Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to Senate to House Bill 49? Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
That amendment is has passed the Committee of the Whole. We are back on the bill. Question on the bill. Senator, Vice President Nicholas, go ahead.
Ask with respect to this bill, and having heard the testimony and the committee, and not sure who the constituents are that are requesting this, and partly, frankly, is my concern that when the opening remarks of the chairman of the committee is that the basis, one of the reasons why we need to have these facilities is in order to get federal health care immunity that applies to these institutions. My experience is that our free clinic probably never been sued and probably never will be sued. And my practical experience is the primary care doctors, particularly internists and family practice doctors, are very rarely ever sued. And if they ever are sued, in almost all instances, the verdicts are in their favor. So I have to admit that I discount that. I'm not interested or concerned about the whether or not people are sued or not sued, because, frankly, those cases are unsuccessful against these institutions. So if you take that motivation out, which seems to be a primary motivation of the bill, I come back to the question is what's the impact on our hospital? And to say that, well, these are Medicaid patients that the hospital doesn't want, I don't find that very persuasive. I think that if they are non-paying, if these are all patients who can't pay, who end up in our free clinic, that I can understand if we're taking there. But if they're taking all those patients that can't pay, I don't know how these institutions run the year after we give them $1 million. If they're taking Medicaid patients, and we're trying to reduce our cost at the state because these are less expensive than sending to our Medicaid clientele to paying institutions, fair enough. But the truth is that most of our institutions, our hospitals, have fixed costs. And their fixed costs, they've got emergency rooms, they have, they're equipped to provide a certain amount of care, and they rely on this Medicaid population to help pay those fixed costs that aren't going to vary next month or the following month, because we still want to have a certain amount of doctors there attending to emergency care patients. If you're an insured person, you want to have a doctor there, and if all of a sudden the next day there's not enough revenue to support one doctor and you show up, well, the doctor is not here. He's because we couldn't afford to keep a full-time doctor. And I'm not hearing, I'd like more explanation and assurances that that there's a need out there for this that's been demonstrated. When we see the map that was presented to us at committee, it looked to me like most of the communities already had either a free clinic or one of these clinics out there, and it looks like the healthcare system is kind of determined where they can be supported and not, and then to throw $1 million into a new facility and only find that it's going to hurt other institutions and then go broke a year, that doesn't seem like very good judgment either. So I guess I'm looking for a little bit more persuasion that there is an existing need and there's going to be no injury or harm to our communities.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman. The push for this comes from the shortage that we have all over the state of primary care providers. We need to get more of them in this state. This seemed to be the best way to do it. And frankly, Mr. Chairman, I know the legal community wants to deny the impact that the tort liability system has. But, in fact, it makes it difficult to recruit physicians to Wyoming. This is labeled as an unfriendly state, and the doctors don't want to come here because of it. And these people, by being under the tort claims, the Federal Tort Claims Act, they can recruit because they're not under our tort liability system. They don't have our malpractice problems. And that's the plain fact of the matter. Mr. Chairman, I have trouble with the argument of competition with the hospitals. These clinics are providing, Mr. Chairman, primary care. The emergency room is just about the worst way and the most expensive way to provide primary care. If you want to drive the Medicaid budget up, insist on your clients go to the emergency room. Now, emergency rooms are designed to handle emergencies. They have evolved into a place that anybody can go that can't get care they can afford any other way. And a matter of fact, I think in a lot of cases, the discussion that the hospital would be better off to get one of these clinics to put an office right next to their emergency room to divert those cases that distract the emergency doctors from what they're really for. So let's use a little common sense, Mr. Chairman. This is a bill that will help a great part of our state that has trouble recruiting physicians, trouble retaining physicians, and is contributing to shortages and difficulties all over the state. I urge its adoption.
Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion to the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 49. Those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
House Bill 49 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Senate, keep in mind the schedule that we have before us. I'm going to urge you again to keep that in mind. The pressure that's being borne is not by you, but by me. And and so, if you want me to get on my knees, I will. but we're moving along, and we need to have these debates. And quite frankly, you're going to see some shuffling of general file, particularly tomorrow. And some of the less weighty issues are probably not going to, may have difficulty being heard this session. But, I'm going to do my best to make those judgment calls. But the more you can help me out, the better. And with that, I move that the Senate or the Committee of the Whole beg leave to rise and sit again.
At what time?
I'm
sorry. You have heard the motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
I was going to say it
1:30. Anybody opposed? Motion passes.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate stand adjourned until 1:30.
We will stand at recess until 1:30.
Sorry, stand in recess. Excuse me.
Okay, let's go on. Let's go on to the announcement, Senator Geis.
Mr. President, your Committee Agriculture, Public Land, Water Resources will meet immediately up in our ag room, and then you can come back and get something to eat afterwards. We're going to discuss interim topics.
Okay, we'll have to hold the talking down just a little bit till we get through these announcements. Senators in the back. Go ahead, Senator Beavell.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, will have a joint meeting with the House Committee on Thursday, February 24th, upon adjournment over in the House in room H-18.
Thank you. Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. President. Remind the committee members and folks that your committee number 7, Corporations, is meeting in joint with our friends from the House to discuss interim topics. We were supposed to start at noon, so we'll get over there as soon as we can. We might grab a quick sandwich and just head down there.
Other announcements? Senator Burns.
Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, is meeting as soon as we recess for lunch down at H-10, the House TRW committee room, to hear from the various agencies for interim topics.
Other announcements? Seeing none. You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion is carried. The Senate will stand recessed until 1:30 p.m. this afternoon. We are at recess.